now at PalaceNet.com, the Palace and DTE Energy Music Theater box offices, all Ticketmaster outlets, or charge at 248-645-6666. Lawn tickets just $10. Part of the Beltire Concert Series.
Yo, this is Randy Jackson. When we searched the country for the best Oreo and milk jingles, there were some great renditions.
Ice cold milk and an Oreo cookie.
And there were some wacky ones.
Oh,
ice cold milk and an Oreo cookie.
Want to decide for yourself? Check out specially marked packages of Oreos. And then head to Oreo.com for a chance to hang with me and win $10,000.
New purchase necessary. Open to U.S. residents 7 and older and 7-2006. Void where prohibited.
He's breaking records.
It ain't just about winning a race, it's about surviving.
They're breaking hearts.
I kid you not, Brittany has a new boyfriend every week.
A&E revs up your summer with Driving Force, a new real-life series about America's fastest drag racing family. Three sisters with the need for speed, and one dad who's just trying to keep up.
I really wanted sons, and now they come home with boyfriends. You don't even want to get into that.
Driving Force premieres tomorrow at 9, 8 Central, only on A&E.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome everybody listening in the Detroit area, which includes southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, and northern Ohio. And, listen to my voice. Starting to get a little bad. How do we have summer colds? Are our immune systems really all crashing? Anyways, I can do it. Anyway, thank you for the person who's corrected me on that. Night Call is brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit's sweatshop-free clothing store, located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road into Quinder and Warren, and online at wakingupstore.com. And there's going to be an expo out there, sponsored by the Waking Up Store, September. Right, I'll have all the details for you. I'm going to be speaking, and thanks to Mike Kitchen, the proprietor. I wonder how this is all going to work. I'm all stuffed with Sudafed, and also thanks to Shannon, who provided me with the Yoga Mudra, which is supposed to clear things. So things got a little better, but what would it have been like without one or the other? Well, we'll see. I got both things going for me. So I need you more than usual. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. Get on the phone and save my voice, all right? Call talkyes at yahoo.com. I got my hot tea here, and we're all ready to roll. As we talk, Lebanon is being destroyed by Israel. The conventional reporting is pretty much that because of Hezbollah attacks and capture of two Israeli soldiers, that this is what it precipitated. And it's kind of an odd way to look at it as a rationale for destroying Lebanon. Hezbollah, of course, controls good parts of southern Lebanon with its militia. So, pardon me. So you'd say, well, okay, we're going to attack southern Lebanon, but the whole infrastructure of Lebanon is being destroyed, the purpose of which isn't entirely clear. But let's look at some of this. Hezbollah and Israel traded rocket and missile barrages for a sixth day on Monday as warfare, it's already Monday there, has erupted in the Middle East, showing no signs of easing. Hezbollah rockets struck deep inside Israel, killing eight people in the northern city of Haifa. Israel retaliated with waves of missile from Lebanon's north to south and into the Bekaa Valley near Syria. Now, I think even with, as usual, fairly shallow reporting, it's pretty clear that the Lebanese government does not have the wherewithal to stop Hezbollah. That the Hezbollah militia is probably equal to the Lebanese army. So to initiate a suppression of Hezbollah would essentially mean another civil war, which would destroy Lebanon the way it was 20 years ago. So you can say, well, maybe it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. I don't know really how to sort that out. Toll on both sides rose to above 200, as you can imagine, because although certainly the missiles from the Hezbollah side are going pretty random, the destructive power of Israel's air force and army is much, much superior by a factor of, 20 probably. So the vast majority of people dying on the Lebanese side are civilians, and it's about 50-50 for the Hezbollah rockets. All terrible, terrible. I condemn both sides, to tell you the truth. But if the idea, see, you wonder what these people have in mind, and this is really a point at which we should involve ourselves in critical thinking. Seems pretty cut and dried on the face of it. Hamas, armed sector of Hamas, a few weeks ago initiated armed attack on the Israeli Defense Force and took prisoner one of its members. That's why then the army's gone back into Gaza, the Israeli army, after allegedly withdrawing. We'll get to the allegedly part in a minute. Hezbollah, for one reason or another, usually the people say, oh, they're nuts, they're crazy. Well, they're not that at all. I think they're all mad. The Israelis, Hezbollah, Hamas, Bush, all of them, they're all quite mad. They're just all think they can solve problems that are insolvable by warfare, and it can't be done. Can I do the show? I thought I could, or I wouldn't have started. So the idea, allegedly, I have a lot of allegedly, is to drive Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon and not allow it to keep raining missiles on Israel. Doesn't that make a lot of sense on the face of it? You got somebody that's attacking you, so you're going to go in and get rid of them. However, according to the latest report from Lebanon, Hezbollah appears in control of all of Lebanon. So has this worked, even with the immense power? I mean, think about Iraq, too. Here's the immense power, very similar circumstances of the United States. In there now for going on 4 years, fighting guerrilla forces, of which the U.S. Armed Forces severely outnumber and severely outgun, yet cannot stop, and things are getting worse and worse and worse. This is like Iraq on speed, because this has all come about in a minute. Hezbollah and its backers, not the government, now appear in control of Lebanon's fate. So what the hell has been accomplished here? After moderating their stance in recent years, the guerrillas surged back to the war front with a surprise attack on Israel and a sophisticated arsenal, leaving Lebanon's politicians and army looking nearly powerless. So how in the hell could the Lebanese government do anything? And why is Israel attacking civilian portions of Beirut and Tyre and some of these other cities like that that are destroying essentially the infrastructure that was rebuilt after the civil war there with billions and billions and billions of dollars? Also, there's 25,000 Americans there. What about the 25,000 Americans? Nothing happens over there with the United States without the United States. Okay, you may have noticed that it says Israeli F-16s. Well, where the hell did they get those? Where did they get the money to pay for them? That's from you and me. So where are the proxies that are supplying the war material? Keep on ringing, by the way. I think my producer, Jay Hudson, is cooking hot dogs at this time. So just be patient, and we'll get you on the air. 8 Canadians have been killed by the Israelis. And situation of the Lebanese and Palestinian population is absolutely desperate. They are living in the worst possible circumstances. Do we blame Hamas and Hezbollah? To a large extent, they certainly have a responsibility here. But here, this is interesting. I'm going to try this. I don't know why I am giving my... hey, guys, if I got to answer the phone... All right, thank you. Thank you for picking it up. All right. 313-298-WRIF. I know those hot dogs are on the grill and all that, but we need to do this show. Here's something from Tanya Reinhardt. Now, she's a professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University, author of Palestine, Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948 and the Roadmap to Nowhere. So, this is an Israeli. It's called The Israeli Defense Force is Hungry for War. So we usually think of the Israelis as these people that want peace, that provide roadmaps, that make generous offers, and nothing is farther from the truth. Here's what Tanya Reinhart, the Israeli professor, says. Whatever may be the fate of the captive soldier, Gilad Shalit, the Israeli army is the Israeli army's war in Gaza is not about him. As senior security analyst Alex Fishman widely reported, the Israeli army was prepared for an attack months earlier and was constantly pushing for it with the goal of destroying the Hamas infrastructure and its government. So what's going on here is that Hamas got elected to represent the Palestinian people. They agreed to a ceasefire. They were initiating no armed incursions into Israel, and they were going to attempt to govern this mess that the Israelis have created in the occupied territories, that they occupy illegally under international law and illegally under every single United Nations resolution, which the United States always says are very important, right? Because that's how Bush, to some extent, justified his assault, invasion, occupation of Iraq. And according to Tanya Reinhart from Tel Aviv University, the army initiated an escalation on June 8th. See, this is what we miss. This is what we miss. But this is very important. The army initiated an escalation on June 8th when it assassinated Abu Samhadad, excuse me, let me say this right, Samhadana, a senior appointee of the Hamas government, and intensified its shelling of the Gaza Strip. So here this provocation begins, breaks the ceasefire on the part of Israel. Governmental authorization for action on a larger scale was already given by June 12th, but was postponed in the wake of global reverberations caused by the killing of civilians by the Israeli armed force bombing the next day. The abduction of the soldier released the safety catch, and the operation began on June 28th with the destruction of the infrastructure in Gaza and the mass detention of the Hamas leadership in the West Bank, which was also planned weeks in advance. So this was a plan on the part of Israel to destroy the representatives, the legal, democratically elected representatives of the Palestinian people. And you say, well, gee, they talk about the destruction of Israel. Well, talk is cheap. And anybody with any realistic sense knew that there was no capacity to do that, even if there was an intention. So this goes on quite a bit. Let's see. In the eyes of many Palestinians, the Qassams, these rockets, are a response to the war Israel has declared on them. As a student from Gaza said to the New York Times, why should we be the only ones who live in fear? With these rockets, the Israelis feel fear too. We will have to live in peace together or live in fear together. And so, again, whether you agree with this or not, you may not. I think that there's a lot more going on than what may seem either immediately, quote, logical, or what you get in the mainstream, out of the mainstream media, which has no history connected with it whatsoever. It all happened today. It's all immediate. So here we learn, this is not being denied by the Israelis. In fact, I think Haaretz, one of the newspapers there in Israel, said, has broke that news, that Israel had been looking for the moment that it could invade Gaza. Let's see. Let's look at another. I don't want to read all of this or all of these or all of this, but this is from Working for Change, Jove Parrish. Where's Bush? Only one man stands between Israel and World War III. Unfortunately, it's the president. And he says the leaders of Israel are brutal and could not care less about human rights, civilian casualties, international law, or the commission of war crimes, but they are not stupid. He asks, why did Israel cut the legs out from a pro-Western, anti-Syrian Lebanese government by not only launching the inevitable retaliatory strikes at Hezbollah strongholds in Lebanon, but by essentially declaring war on the entire country, ensuring, as the least of its consequences, the effective end of domestic political support for the Lebanese government? Why not offer Beirut the assistance it clearly would need to go after Hezbollah itself and help bring the entire country under Beirut's control? Such a move would have steep political costs to Beirut, but not as steep as having Israel's military pulverize the country, which is going on right now. The Israelis knew something. The rockets that struck Haifa are a new development in the conflict, and they are Iranian-made. The blockade is Israel's move to prevent more Iranian arms from flowing into Lebanon. I'm not sure I buy that. Why is this alarming? Because it's a given at this point that Israeli Defense Forces soldiers are, after a six-year absence, going to re-enter southern Lebanon to sweep out Hezbollah positions and try to reestablish a buffer zone protecting Israeli territory. Only the buffer will now have to be three times wider. That's a given. Israel will do it. The last time Israel waded in here in 1982, there were massacres and a human rights disaster. And so there's going to be more of that. An Israeli attack on Iran or on Iran's ally Syria will be instantly perceived in Tehran and throughout the Muslim world as an attack in which the United States is complicit, even if the U.S. military does not directly participate. Such an attack will place American troops and ships at risk of instant retaliation in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Persian Gulf, and for that matter throughout the Middle East, not to mention the special ops forces already in Iran itself. No Israeli leader would even contemplate such a strike without a green light from Washington, and no Israeli leader would launch it without notifying Washington first. This is a country of which we've given billions and tens of billions of dollars, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars, for this military wherewithal to carry out operations like that. So they are not under any circumstances vulnerable, which vulnerability would mean that they would have to make a proper peace with the Palestinians. You say, wow, God, if they couldn't protect themselves, they'd get overrun. Not if the United States would be willing to secure Israel's safety and security. Let's see. More. Tehran knows this, as does the entire Muslim world. If Israel widens this war, Iran will retaliate. The United States will be at war with Iran. All sides will have one or another unprovoked attack they can point to an enemy as having perpetrated, and we will suddenly be in the thick of a war that at minimum involves Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Palestine, and abuts the Persian Gulf, the Gulf Emirates, and oil-rich Saudi Arabia. That's what this is all bringing us. Now, this sounds a lot. How many of you know the history of World War I? A war which I always say, why in the world did the United States fight in? And I mean, no one ever comes up with that answer, because there isn't a good one. Other than we wanted to secure the loans Britain... I mean, it was a war for blood, essentially, or for loans or for money. But in any event, it began with a spark that was caused by the assassination in Sarajevo in Serbia of the Archduke Ferdinand, and suddenly all the world powers are tumbling into this conflagration that took tens of millions of lives. Could it happen here? I keep thinking, man, damn, it couldn't happen. Could it really? The military options for American success are virtually negligible. The scenarios for military disaster are numerous. The economic impact on oil markets alone will inevitably be global and dire, and I haven't even gotten to the fact that Bush himself might launch an attack, or that not only the U.S. but Israel, too, has a full nuclear arsenal, and that beyond Iran's terrorist connections around the world, other terror groups, al-Qaeda for one, are unlikely to stand idly by while this nightmare unfolds. Is it possible that there really are, rather than these goofy plots that Attorney General Gonzalez tries to pump up as having some real danger to us that they arrest every once in a while, that there are actually sleeper cells in the United States that are fully armed with some horrible weapon that are waiting for something like what could be on the agenda? Could we be right in the middle of a war? There hasn't been a war on these territories since 1941, and even that was not on the mainland. Since, I guess, September 11th, as we should say. Would we see more of that? American media in the last 36 hours, a crisis has been as execrable in covering the unfolding drama as it has been in covering Israel's attack on Gaza over the last 6 months, and especially the last 2 weeks. Hezbollah and Hamas are being casually lumped together, and then it goes on, a whole thing here. Let's see. Hezbollah, like Iran, is Shiite. Hamas is Sunni. Hamas is an elected government. Hezbollah has a political wing, but it holds relatively little power in the Lebanese government. Israel has been blockading Gaza for half a year, and for two weeks has been and still is mercilessly bombing Gaza, destroying its infrastructure and killing and terrorizing its residents. The Hezbollah attack was unprovoked, except as an opportunistic gesture of solidarity with Gaza's Palestinians, which I think there's more to it than that, but this man is obviously not sympathetic to him. Now the Lebanese and the Palestinians are both caught in the crossfire. Iran and its proxies on one side, Israel and Washington on the other, and acting like chess players who, having both thought out a sequence of moves well in advance, are now moving pieces and sacrificing pawns. That's the ordinary people at breakneck speed. There'll be a great many pawns sacrificed, as well as most of the other pieces on the board, and the end game will inevitably be truly ugly unless someone intervenes. And only, he says, George Bush can. Perilous times indeed, not just for Israelis, Palestinians, and Lebanon, but for all of us. We could stop this in a minute, but Bush isn't. When was the first bombing of a civilian population, and by who? Unless you know this. I didn't know this till I went to peacebuttons.info. I think that's where it is. Or you can go to my website and go down to Carl Bunin's good site where he lists This Week in History. The first ever aerial military bombing of a civilian population was a U.S. squadron of airplanes which killed 300 people at Ocotal, Nicaragua, on July 17, 1927. 300 people killed at Ocotal, Nicaragua, by a Marine squadron of airplanes in 1927. Now, what do you think? What the hell is this about? Well, the Marines invaded and occupied Nicaragua and stayed there for, I think, about 12 years to fortify U.S. investments there. I mean, the people had gotten kind of uppity and were wanting some control over things themselves. There's more, but I want to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. All right, let's we'll see who we have here. Oh, I got to do this. I remember how to do this. We got to get our little mouse out here and click it and say hello to Chris in Roseville. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to talk about this. This is really starting to sicken me a little bit. I mean, they want peace, and then all of a sudden they get peace, and what, they just start shooting at each other? I mean, I don't understand this stuff. I mean, if they want World War III to happen, I say bring it on now. Screw all this stuff. I'm tired of waiting for it, you know?
Well, what if it hits us, though?
Then fine. I'm tired of waiting for, you know, terrorists to come into my freaking work and blow me up because I'm American. I'm waiting to hear from North Korea trying to blow us up because their leader's too stupid to admit that communism doesn't work anymore. I mean, I'm just done.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what that means in practical terms. What we have to look at, I mean, in the manner that Bush is trying to cut a deal with North Korea, because they have nuclear weapons. He didn't try to cut a deal with Saddam Hussein because he knew that he didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. In that manner, that diplomacy could solve almost all of this. But it would mean certain concessions from all sides. And believe it, these weak countries, a country that is in shambles, Chris, like you correctly indicate about North Korea, has a lot to gain by a peace treaty that the United States has never signed with North Korea. And a guarantee of no military action against it, and the kind of economic aid that they might, that they need out of a system that appears to be unworkable. Let's not say appears to be; it is unworkable. But these have to, the United States, the biggest power in the world, and the initiatives have to come from us. That's for sure. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I hope we're not waiting in the manner that you are. Bring it on. Well, man, I hope it doesn't happen. Kind of weird. William in Clinton Township. William, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
I want to tell you right off the bat, what's scaring me is there's a problem with misinformation in this country. Callers like Chris, you know, he's misinformed. This is the paranoia that the government wants us to feel. Don't understand the problem, just want to kill everybody, let's do it. No, that's wrong. I can tell you, this country is very diverse. I am an Arab American. I am a Sunni Muslim. My family, I'm third generation. Okay. I've lived here, same neighborhood that Chris comes from. There are not terrorists waiting to attack or kill people in their workplace. This is all a lie. I urge people as Americans tomorrow, today, right now, call your senator. Leave a message. Tell our government to stop this right now. Because Christians and Muslims, just civilians, they're dying. Those Americans, those Canadians have died. That's an act of war.
Yeah.
I mean, what is going on? Chris, your knowledge is, you're right to the point. You know exactly what's going on. You know how World War I started? Your knowledge is there. You know what's going on. Everybody stands to make money, but the people that, the Americans, the working people.
Well,
Russia's waiting in the wings to finance Iran. This is going to happen if the people in this country do not scream loud enough, make it stop. Because as soon as they hit Syria with a bomb, it's over. Iran's going to get in directly. And our troops, our American troops, are right there in the middle in Iraq.
Yeah, and what's also, we talk about our troops, the Mahdar army, the Shiite army in Baghdad that controls a lot of political power, has a very strong militia, said it would go on the offensive once again if the United States or Israel did the kind of actions that are going on now. I mean, we're going to be lucky to get out of this without a major catastrophe. In fact, for the people of Lebanon, it already is a major catastrophe. And why this is, why Lebanon is being pulverized is way beyond me.
The thing about, it's just, people, you know as well as I do, Israel is not, I mean, it's supposed to be a democracy, but it's a Zionist democracy. And it's just like that guy, you know, the president of Iran, yeah, he's a warmonger. He's kind of nuts. But his statement in the paper today is true. He says the Zionists are acting like Hitler, and that's what they are. And what you've described of what Israel is going to do in southern Lebanon is exactly right. They're going to occupy it even more because their goal is to take it over and continue to spread and colonize the Middle East.
Well, I don't think, I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't think they want to go too far beyond, what is it, Eretz, I can't remember, something like Eretz Israel, which is Greater Israel, which the far right wing has been disposed of for a while because they wanted to make all of the West Bank and Gaza part of Israel, and Sinai, all of that, because they see this wacky biblical stuff as guiding them rather than any sense of people living in peace and living as neighbors. But the situation could be easily, given compared to what's going on now, resolved by creating and allowing a viable Palestinian state of which on the West Bank and Gaza, from which all Israeli settlers have been removed, and begin normal relations. I think it's quite really as simple as that. All right, William, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's see, here's Rich from Farmington. Rich, hi, you're on the air. Wait a minute here, why isn't this working? Rich, hi, you're on the air.
Good, glad to hear it, Peter. Thanks very much. I heard Joe Nolenberg on WWJ yesterday, live interview. He's my local congressman. I think I'm embarrassed to say it. I don't know much about him, but I got a couple of his campaign mailings.
Yeah, actually, I heard that same interview.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, how many times did he blame Iran for this?
Yeah, well, quite a few.
Exactly. And he wasn't, whoever was interviewing him should have said, you know, what's your proof on that?
Yeah.
It sounds to me, every time I hear Iran, you know, obviously my ears perk up, because I'm just looking for the similarities between how they led us into Iraq. And, you know,
sure.
I think they're just out there saying things that can't be proven at this point.
Hey, Rich, you do have an alternative in the 9th Congressional District there, and that's Nancy Skinner. Are you aware of that?
Is she running against Nolenberg?
She is running against Joe Nolenberg. There's going to be, oh, man, I don't have this. I will get this soon. But there's going to be a candidates meeting for some reason or other in Oak Park next Sunday, which is not which is not in Nancy's district, but it's SkinnerForCongress.com. SkinnerForCongress.com. She's an old colleague of mine, a wonderful talk show host, and has a damn good chance of replacing this horrible Bushoid, Joe Nolenberg. And anybody should feel free, by the way, to call in and give Joe Nolenberg's web address, to be fair, or you can just Google Joe Nolenberg. But Nancy's pretty decent, and there is a real alternative in the 9th District. She needs help. She's got a lot of endorsements, but still, She needs foot soldiers. She needs lots of people that want to get involved in an electoral campaign. All right, Rich, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Stan from Garden City. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Peter, how you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Last weekend, I talked about flag burning. That ruffled my tail feathers. But, Peter, I'm so heavily burdened with this. It's not good. I watched Tim Russert on Meet the Press, and you got Newt Gingrich on there talking about a third world war, that it is a third world war. And it's a bunch of hypocrisy. It's been a third world war since 1999 and even before that. It's just escalated to the point of no return now, is my opinion. But, you know, they're like hubcaps. Everybody's entitled to one.
Wait a minute. You're supposed to have four.
Yeah, there you go.
It's like a-holes. Everyone has one.
Yeah, I was being more nice. I didn't want
That's
to say
all right.
That.
It's 11:30. I didn't say the whole word. So.
Praise the Lord, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
But, Peter, I'm more interested in what you have to say tonight, but I'll leave on a note that these gas prices, they're recalculating them with precision and opening stock market at Monday, tomorrow. They're going to crucify us all.
Yeah, they are.
You talk about a hot time summer in the city. This is really bad. You're talking about some Mad Max scenario here, man. I'm telling you. But you take care, and I'll talk to you when you can.
All right, Stan. Thanks for calling in from Garden City. We'll be right back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
news. I've got this time on my hands. You are the one to abuse. Yes, I'm found a reason. Now I need an excuse. I've got this time on my hands. You are the one to abuse. Yes, I'm found a reason. Now I need an excuse. I've got this time.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We're talking about, obviously, about the situation in the Middle East. Your calls are welcome, 313-298-WRIF. Emails to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo. And thanks to Dennis and his friends at the South Pole, who just sent me a whole bunch of photographs of all of them. Damn, it looks like they're just in a nice little gymnasium. But they say that includes Lynette, who knows me from 4th Street in Detroit. They just had the 4th Street Fair this Saturday, I guess. And it's amazing. All right, thanks to the Internet. One of the things, of course, that's so disturbing about the expenditure of hundreds of billions, now into the trillions, that have gone for over the years for preparation for war and foreign aid to countries like Israel, the prosecution and occupation of the invasion and an occupation of Iraq, is we don't have much money for anything anymore. This is an article from the Associated Press. On a single day in June, an Australian-Spanish partnership paid $3.8 billion to lease, you ready for this, the Indiana Toll Road. An Australian company bought a 99-year lease on Virginia's Pocahontas Parkway, and Texas officials decided to let a Spanish-American partnership build and run a toll road from Austin to Seguin for 50 years. Few people, a lot of us know this, so it says in the article. A lot of us know this, but it says in the article, few people know that the toll roads from the U.S. side of the tunnel between Detroit and Windsor, Canada, go to a subsidiary of an Australian company, which also owns a bridge in Australia. So you think, wow, man, we're just getting bought up. But this is kind of says, oh, that's pretty good. It says the Indiana Toll Road lease is a better deal because the proceeds will pay for urgent projects such as road and bridge improvements. Now, we are the richest country in the world, right? We have hundreds of billions of dollars a year taken from us in taxes, and that adds up real quickly to like a trillion or so over 10 years. And it says this is precisely why cities and states have begun to look to foreign investors. Between 1980 and 2004, people drove 94% more highway miles, but the number of new highway lane miles rose only by 6%. Washington is not likely to produce more money to build roads. No, not likely at all. We're going to be likely to take our tax dollars instead of building roads. We're going to take it and throw it down the rat hole of Iraq, down the rat hole of aid to Israel and Egypt and bases all over the world that if we would make peace would not be necessary. So there's people out there that hate us. Well, carrot and stick would do it. But there's a vested interest in keeping this permanent state of warfare. The fear that generates support for the incompetent and cruel people that rule everywhere from here to the Middle East. And also, it's a racket. So rather than this money returning to us in jobs and in infrastructure projects completed to make our lives more comfortable for the money that we give to the government in taxes, instead it goes to the war industries. It goes to Boeing. It goes to the, I don't know, I can't think of all my at the moment, but you know what they are. You could think of about three more for me. Washington is not likely to produce more money to build roads. The Federal Highway Fund, which will have a balance of about $16 billion by the end of 2006, will run out in 2009 or 2010, according to the White House. Well, sure. These evil morons in Washington spent it all. We gave them our money, and they gave it away to Halliburton. They gave it away to Israel. They gave it away to Egypt. They gave it away to these little emirates. They pay off these awful dictatorships in Central Asia because they think they can get a pipeline for their oil buddies. We're being robbed. We're being screwed. We're having our heritage destroyed. You say, well, you know, we don't want to be subjected to terrorism. Don't you understand that the people that run things now have a vested interest in terrorism continuing? It's part of their meat and potatoes? All right, 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and let's see, we have Daniel and Warren. Daniel, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, man?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks for having a show that talks about real stuff.
Oh, good. Glad to.
You talk about a lot of things, but the last thing that just kind of hit me is you're talking about the gas prices and this and that and the road commission, but I thought back a couple years ago when the gas prices went up, it was to fix our roads. And then they go to war. They go to war, which I think Bush had something to do with 9/11. They go to war looking for bin Laden. They can't find bin Laden, so they get Saddam. And they still can't find bin Laden. And then they're talking about the war in Lebanon and all this stuff. And the guy talked about earlier about terrorists coming to this country and has work or whatever. I don't know. I just think as Americans, maybe we just need to band together and accept what's going to happen. Because it's crazy how the government can conceal our vote. Like, our vote doesn't even matter no more. It's like what they want. It's all about old money. It's all about the millionaires, whoever they want to elect in office.
And there's enough evidence, at least to make the argument. I say it's persuasive and conclusive that both the 2000 and 2004 election were stolen. That the Mexican election that just occurred under the aegis of Bush's hand, that his operatives were involved in it, was stolen as well. So as long as we're just going to sit and think, man, this is awful, it will be awful, and it will probably continue to be more awful. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Yeah, I just saw this thing. I meant to print it out. Let me see if I can do it by memory. But in Virginia, under the Eisenhower administration, they built this huge bomb shelter that would hold 1,000 people. And they were worried that the Soviets were going to lob some nukes at us. Of course, that was never, ever on the agenda. That's a great object lesson. So if you know, that old thing about if you don't learn from history, you are condemned to repeat it. We do it every single day. It's like history reinvents itself every week, and no one pays any attention, except for a few people, pays any attention to the lessons learned. That when the suits get on television and they've got graphs and charts, they're lying about almost everything. Or if you don't accept that, I right away accept it as that. At least be questioning. They have lied to us so many times. They lied to us about the Spanish-American War. They lied to us about World War I. They lied to us about Vietnam, and on and on and on and on. And so, given the track record, and this is, you know, cross-party, cross-historical periods and all that, you would do much better off when it comes to a crisis point like this to figure everybody in positions of importance and media are lying. Work from that. Maybe then you'll find out, well, no, this time they're not. But to immediately accept that, this is what they want. This is, what does Noam Chomsky call this? Check that man, Chomsky, if you never have heard of him. Chomsky, the manufacture of consent. There's still all the trappings. In fact, even the worst dictators always had these elections, right? And they'd say, we got, like Stalin, got 98% of the vote. He'd say, find out who the 2% were. They're nervous because these brittle structures of dictatorship are, you know, they're worried. But that I think is a good premise to begin with. All right, I don't see who's next here, so I'm just going to take the person who's been waiting the longest. It's Greg in Sterling Heights. Greg, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
How you doing tonight, Pete?
Good, excellent. Thank you.
Although I got a cold. Wondering about the situation about, you guys were talking about North Korea. If we're worried about Israel and worried about and talking about going to North Korea and maybe doing something about Israel, and we're already in Iraq, wouldn't that be like spreading your resources thin? Because we're helping everybody out. And
well, I don't think we're helping anybody out.
That's not the intent. We're talking about you all trying to help everybody out, more or less trying to play Superman. But if didn't the news say or people say that China was talking about maybe going in North Korea and we wouldn't let them or something?
No,
or?
No, they just didn't. They didn't want a certain resolution. Well, I think who knows? It could all be hopeless. I mean, sometimes people get themselves into jams that the solutions, the sensible one, never makes any sense. Like I mentioned World War I before, an archduke gets shot in Sarajevo in 1914, and a huge world war ensues that kills tens of millions of people. What sense does that make? I mean, here were these great statesmen in Austria, in Germany, and the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and Britain, and France, Italy, the United States, and you could think, well, it must be a sensible way to solve this without sending tens of millions of troops to their death. Now it's, of course, millions of civilians. Then it used to be millions of troops. Now it's millions of civilians. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. What did I just see? Oh, Andy from Amherstburg, Ontario, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You stated a few times during the first hour that this conflict could be settled swiftly, the one in the Middle East. I think this is impossible considering the fact that these invasions have clearly been planned for weeks by Israel, perhaps months in advance, waiting only for a way to rally their country behind them. I agree. It seems the government knew about this inevitable war well in advance, which should explain why they stayed in Iraq to have a base for operations and then started a heavy smear campaign against Iraq. So as to R, I'm kind of confusing. I actually edited as I went along. Let me see. They stated a few. I think this is impossible considering these invasions. Anyway, I am fearful in my worst moments that it's just no solution to this. But as long as we're the spectators, as long as we sit watching it all unfold, while the clearly mad among us. The small percentage of truly mad are the ones, and that's politicians, that's guerrillas, that's people that are willing to go off to war to kill civilians and all that, that commit acts that are truly mad. Well, yeah, there's got to be some point where we, the vast majority of the world, the 95% of us who aren't mad, who want peace in the world, that our way gets put into practice for once. Let's go to James in Kenosha, Wisconsin. James, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make two quick comments regarding the Middle East. One is there was an article you just read that said George Bush was the only person standing between Israel and the total World War III. But if it's true that Israel does not act without U.S. sanctions, then George Bush has already acted. And so waiting for him to somehow intervene and head us off from some sort of nuclear catastrophe is foolish.
Well, I agree with you, and I'm sure that the United States knew in advance, because we have everything from liaisons between their War Department and ours, and also I'm sure any number of spies within their government, as they have within ours, so that they knew that the Israeli Defense Forces was planning an incursion and only waiting for the incident that could justify their reinvasion of Gaza and the overthrow by military means of the democratically elected government that the Palestinians had put in place.
And in fact, we worked in concert with them in terms of that reason to reinvade the Gaza, in that the very first shot across the bow was not militarily, but it was economically. Well, immediately after the election of Hamas, the U.S. and Israel led a worldwide economic boycott of the newly installed government in an attempt to bring down the government of Hamas. And that was with it was the U.S., it was Israel, and then the EU joined in. And so that was the first shot fired.
Yeah, we like democracy unless it doesn't go our way.
Yeah, exactly. Finally, there was an article I'd read before we invaded Iraq, and I can't recall the guy's name, some neocon think tank denizen, and the quote stuck with me. And in terms of the grand plan, he stated that the road to Cairo leads from Baghdad through Damascus. And I hate to say it, but we're looking at it unfold in front of our eyes.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. There's a little more here from the article by Tanya Reinhardt, who is a professor at the Tel Aviv University, very critical of what her government is doing. According to Israel, they ended the occupation in Gaza when it evacuated its settlers from the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinians' behavior therefore constitutes ingratitude. That is, you know, this latest military deal. But there is nothing further from reality than this description. In fact, it, as was already stipulated in the disengagement plan, Gaza remains under complete Israeli military control, operating from outside. Israel prevented any possibility of economic independence for the Strip, and from the very beginning, Israel did not implement a single one of the clauses of the agreement on border crossings of November 2005. Israel simply substituted the expensive occupation of Gaza with a cheap occupation, one in which Israelis view exempts it from the occupier's responsibility to maintain the Strip and from concern for the welfare and the lives of 1.5 million residents as determined in the Fourth Geneva Convention, which they routinely, as I'm saying this now, routinely ignore. Let me get you on the air. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Chris from New Baltimore. Chris, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a first-time caller.
Welcome.
Very good show.
Appreciate it.
First, I'd just like to make a comment about, you said something about the jobs going overseas.
Can you turn your radio all the way off?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Because we're on a bit of a delay.
All right. First thing you said about the jobs going, about U.S. jobs going overseas and that we're losing jobs.
Well,
I do believe that
we've
our economy has grown by 4% in the past 3 years, each year.
Yeah.
And that's not jobs going overseas. Those are jobs coming here. The solution...
Well, wait a minute. Jobs are not coming here.
Jobs are coming here. If our economy is growing, our
jobs... You think there's... Well, wait a minute. Are we, you saying jobs are coming here from overseas, or we're creating jobs here?
We're creating jobs here.
Well, you know what? I'm sure you must know, Chris, that the response is that if jobs that have been created are routinely pay less than the ones that were lost, that we're losing our manufacturing base at a rapid rate, and that the whole country's in hock to foreign banks because Bush depleted the surplus and now is running the country further and further into debt, even though they had this little blip where they say that it came down a little. But what they did, they projected the figures real high, and then they go, it's not as bad as we thought. But still, our taxes are going to pay debt service to banks in London and Shanghai and Tokyo. That's not good. Not good information.
But they and other countries still pay us. But regarding his tax cuts brought more money in to our country through people paying taxes. The tax cuts were good. The tax cuts were working.
Well, they're not really working.
Well, they are working because...
Okay, hold on. I'm sorry. I got to read to you. Here's an economist, Paul Krugman, writing the New York Times. Many observers, even if they acknowledge the rapidly growing concentration of income in the hands of a few, find it hard to believe that this concentration could be proceeding so rapidly as to deny most Americans any gains from economic growth. Yet newly available data shows that that's exactly what happened in 2004, the year they have the most information from, and it's only getting worse. It's reasonably clear that what is happening now is the same as what happened in 2004. Growth in the economy as a whole is mainly benefiting a small elite while bypassing most American families. Here's what happened in 2004. As you said, Chris, correctly, the U.S. economy grew 4.2%. Paul Krugman says a very good number. I'd even say it's robust. Yet last August, the Census Bureau reported that real median family income, the purchasing power of the typical family, which I assume is you as well as me, actually fell. The real median family income, the purchasing power of the typical American family actually fell. Meanwhile, poverty increased, as did the number of Americans without health insurance. So where did the growth go? According to economist Tom Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, who's blah, 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 they show that even if you exclude capital gains from a rising stock market in 2004, the real income of the richest 1% of Americans surged by almost 12.5%. Meanwhile, the average real income of the bottom 99% of the population rose only 1.5%. In other words, a relatively handful of people received most of the benefits of the growth. Hold on. I got one more paragraph. There are a couple of additional revelations in the 2004 data. One is that growth didn't just bypass the poor and the lower middle class, it bypassed the upper middle class. Even people of the 95th percentile of the income distribution, that is people richer than 19 out of 20 Americans, gained only modestly. The big increases went only to people who were already in the economic stratosphere. So, sorry, there goes your argument.
No, I would disagree. Last year I was making under $30,000. This year I started my own business. I'm making well over 50.
Well, so what? I mean, what if you made 10,000 last year and you made 10 million this year? It has to do, Chris, with aggregate statistics. It doesn't have to do with your personal income. The other thing is, as people age, they generally, I'm not sure it's going to be the same for this generation, you make money because you're working at 5:15 at some junk food place, and then you get a job in a tool and die factory, maybe you get to be a foreman. Yeah, so as you get older, you make more money. But what you need to do is take the aggregate statistics of the economy, and under Bush's giveaway to the ultra wealthy, we're getting screwed.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And this hour of Night Call brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store, located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder and Warren. They're online at wakingupstore.com. I was out there visiting with the proprietor, Mike Kitchen. Nice stuff out there. And Mike is going to be sponsoring an expo in September. I'll be speaking, and as things go on, September 16th. Yeah, it's right here in front of me. We'll go in there, say hello to Mike, take a look around, and hey, if you're looking for the Fifth Estate newspaper, remember that from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and the 21st century? That's there as well. So I'm very high on that story. There's something called right livelihood within, I think it's within the Buddhist tradition. So you don't have to be a cutthroat capitalist trying to screw everybody to the largest extent that you can. A number of businesses around that do that, like Avalon Bakery down near the Wayne State University, and probably a lot of others. I just don't know of too many. Our last caller, Chris from, I forgot where he was, we were talking about the economy, and I read all these statistics from the government that said the aggregate income of the typical American family has fallen. So he says, well, I made more money. I was making $30,000. I'm making $50,000. So it must be that Bush's stuff is working. I mean, come on. There's a big picture here. And we have to look at ourselves on any number of levels, certainly on the individual level, certainly our family, our neighborhood, our community, but then our state and our country and the world. So there's an interplay between all of that. And it's important that we, you know, look at it all, or we wind up. I mean, some people only look at the macro version, right, the biggest version of it all, and they miss stuff. Some people only look at themselves. They're sure missing a hell of a lot. All right, our phone number here, 313-298-WRIF, and our email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Night Call is produced by Jay Hudson, also the co-host of WRIF's Motor City Riffs, the fine music program that precedes Night Call at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, so that's in about 55 minutes, a couple of interviews that I did previously, including one about the Middle East situation, and then a fairly wacky one about a serious subject, about teen and gay teen suicide by a transgendered person, which I had a ton of fun talking to her. All right, hang on. If you're, people get so impatient. 313-298-WRIF. It's a talk show. You got to hold on a bit. All right, here is Ron Runs in Macomb. Ron, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing excellent. Thanks for asking.
You heard that Chris's remarks from New Baltimore about our economy and everything. And
said they were going great. That
he repeats
the Bush remarks that we're growing by over 4%, which is true.
Exactly. But, you know, I think people in this country have been kind of led astray. And I don't know, ever since the 60s and 70s and through the 80s with the recessions and all, people don't realize that we put the people into power. We elect our officials to pass our laws and to govern our bodies and take care of us as a population. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's absolutely true. But here's what we've gotten to. I love all you guys. Usually I don't get to talk about all the articles I have. But here, this was an article in the New York Times. It says, Bush will let secret court sift wiretap process. Now, it's this whole stuff about him illegally wiretapping stuff.
Right.
But the verb is important. Bush will let a secret court sift wiretap process. This is like King George.
Exactly.
This is absolutely incredible that that Bush says. And now all of this could be done easily. This was set up by law in the 1970s. Speaking of that, where the United States would the government would not violate the Constitution, but Bush wants to initiate total executive control. Which
right.
is exactly what the Founding Fathers set up the Constitution to make sure it didn't happen. So this guy is making an end run around it. He stuffed the courts with these far right wing ideologues, so he's not going to get caught there. And the Congress, pardon me, just doesn't have a bit of backbone.
Well, the thing about the Middle East crisis too is, you know, that stuff has been going on for thousands of years, and for the United States to get involved in something like that, that's just small-minded on our part. Rather than leaving those people alone and not contributing to their delinquency, we should be building and creating jobs here and keeping our money close to home and rebuild our neighborhoods and rebuild our family values and rebuild our moral fiber in this country. That's our infrastructure, not the politicians running rampant with changing our laws and our codes, but to give us our individual rights and freedoms, and we govern ourselves, basically. I mean, we're not a bunch of idiots that just got off the boat, right?
But think about this. We've gotten to the point, not only are we in hock to all these foreign banks just to make...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's who's financing the U.S. government, because with all the billions of dollars in taxes, everything that comes out of our paycheck every week, we're still in debt because of Bush's policies. But even, I don't know, worse, but probably parallel with that, I don't know if you heard me earlier, that all these states and cities are selling off what would normally be the property of a city or a state to foreign companies, so they'll run our toll roads, they'll run our bridges, like the Ambassador Bridge going to Windsor, which is run by a subsidiary of an Australian company, because they say the United that the states and the cities and what don't have enough money. Why in the hell is a state like Michigan in such financial trouble? Why in the hell is a city like New York? Well, they're mismanaged. That's not true at all. This is endemic all across our country. All right, thanks. Thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it. You know, that reminded me. Oh yeah, since I got all this stuff here, Dick DeVos. That this is for those of you who do not live in Michigan who are listening on the internet, is running for governor against Jennifer Granholm, who's currently the Democratic governor. Now. He's run one of the slickest PR campaigns imaginable. He's a multimillionaire from this pyramid scheme. What is it, Amway? He's the son of the founder, far right wing family, and I guess he's a Republican. You go to his website. I don't know what it is, like DickDeVos.com, DeVos, or you can just Google it. Doesn't say on his website whether he is a Republican or not, but he is. He is. He definitely is. And he apparently never wears a suit coat, at least along the lines of the photographs on his site. I was looking through it. He's always in his shirt sleeves. They're rolled up. He's ready to take care of business, take care of the B-I-Z, as we say, right? Well, this is tangential to this. Public schools perform near private ones in study. The Education Department, that's Bush's department, reported Friday that children in public schools generally performed as well or better in reading and mathematics than comparable children in private schools. Remember that? They were saying that's why we had to have these academies, that's why we needed these vouchers. And the DeVos family is really big in pushing private schools. And I'll get to why in just a half sec. The report, which compared 4th and 8th grade reading and math to nearly 7,000 public schools and more than 530 private schools, so they did significantly better in math than comparable 4th graders in private schools. Additionally, it found that students in conservative Christian schools lagged significantly behind their counterparts in public schools on 8th grade math. Now, those private schools must be a wreck, because these big city school systems are awful. And why haven't we taken our money, just as our last caller said, rather than sending it down these numerous rat holes where everybody on earth, big corporations in the United States and countries across the world, get our tax dollars rather than our kids and our schools? And it's not just Detroit. It's Southgate. It's Southfield. It's lots of places. It's not just inner city schools. It's rural schools that are underfunded. If the economy's doing so good, like Chris said, how come we've got to have private schools? Well, let me tell you something else, why the Dick DeVos's of the world push these private schools. First and foremost, they want to erode the whole concept of public schools. They want to have an ideologically Christian-driven school system, or at least have that as the basis, so they can create a generation of shock troops for their far right-wing movement. Secondly, and who knows, I don't even know if this is in rank order, but the more that they destroy public schools, the more they destroy the teachers' unions. And why do they want to destroy teachers' unions? Because they think that people get in there and they can't get fired and they're bad teachers. That's not the case at all. They want to destroy the teachers' unions because the unions, the teachers' unions, like most unions, are the backbone of the Democratic Party. So as one black minister said about the DeVos's efforts to get private schools in Detroit, when all of a sudden, this is what he said, something like this, when all of a sudden did these white Grand Rapids far-right-wing Christians start caring about black inner-city students? Well, they don't give a good goddamn about it. They're the most conniving, evil, greedy people that have ever hit the... Well, I don't know. No, they're not. It's not like they're anything new. They're like their counterparts in the 19th century that worked kids 14 hours a day, that ruined the lives of three and four generations so they could build up their fortunes. This is the DeVos's and the rest of the wealthy in this country. I mean, yeah, I know. Some of them are doing good. Gates and the guy that just gave all that money to Gates. Don't bother to tell me. I'll think of his name in a second. But what's the third reason? The third reason. I don't know. I can't remember. I don't know if you can tell, but my voice, I got this damn cold. It interfered with my thinking a little. I was telling some people, and friends of mine that broadcast on Air America, they were telling me they were flabbergasted. They say, you don't have a producer? I mean, I have a producer, Jay Hudson, who does wonderful work for me, but he doesn't investigate the story. He doesn't write out, and that's what a lot of producers do for these shows. This is all on my brain. So time to time, the brain doesn't pull it all up. All right, let's continue on. Night Call is the show. Our number is 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and here's Chris. Chris is in Ann Arbor. A lot of Chris's tonight. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, thanks, Pete. That's Warren Buffett you're looking for.
Yeah, right. I would remember.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, on evangelical right-wing Christians, I wanted to get your viewpoint on their support for Israel and, how they want World War III to happen so they can get their rapture.
Yeah.
End of days.
How can I put it? Fundamentalist people of any religion scare me. Yeah. You give a fundamentalist a gun and you got a fascist. Whether it's a Christian, you give a Christian fundamentalist a gun, you give a Muslim fundamentalist a gun, you give a Hindu fundamentalist a gun, you give a Jewish fundamentalist a gun, you've got fascists.
Right. Theocracy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The ultimate in totalitarianism and the ultimate in, what would you call it? I got to think of a different word other than presumption, but something like that, that not only are we going to be ruled by the creed that they decide on, that they are in touch with God or the Godhead, and they know what their particular God wants. And when these representatives of these gods clash, even sometimes within the religion, you think about Christians or about Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland.
Well, no, it's scary.
It is scary.
It's completely scary. But I'm sure you've checked out Adbusters.
Right? I have, both the magazine and the website. Yeah.
They listed the top prominent 50 neocons probably a year ago. And then they bullet marked each one that were Jewish.
Yeah.
And it was a big fright. You know, they were marking Jewish neocons, you know, like they were Nazis or something. But
well, I would say that certainly has a whiff of anti-Semitism, too. What in the world does someone's ethnic origin or religion have to do with whether that they practice or advocate policies?
Yeah? Well, it was the support for Israel. And how?
Well, but here's what's inherent in this. Here's what's inherent in this. And this has come up a lot. Some people have said even the war in Iraq was to defend Israel, which is total nuts. It's all about oil. It has the worst assumptions to it imaginable. And here's the assumption. These wily Jews are able to convince these otherwise well-meaning but sort of naive Gentiles into policies that are not in the basic interests of the United States, so that they get them to do all these different things. Now, the Israel lobby is extraordinarily powerful. It can deliver votes, it delivers money, and in that manner has very frequently is able to get all sorts of measures passed by Congress that are not in the interest of the American people. Well, you know what? They're no different than any other of the lobbies. There's not a lobby. Maybe like the environmental lobbies. But the vast majority of lobbies in the United States regularly get Congress to pass bills that are not in the interest of the United States population as a whole. The banking, the pharmaceutical, the oil, on and on and on. Textiles, the credit, their lobbies act at the behest of the people paying the money. So to single out the Israel lobby is a real mistake. And to identify people by their ethnicity, I think, is a horrid mistake as well.
Well, I mean, you're right. You are right. But
what?
But I mean, but the United States has supported Israel ever since 1967.
Completely, yeah.
Without a doubt, vetoed every UN resolution against Israel. I mean, we are.
Well, and it's done for a number of purposes. First and foremost, it's done because Israel carries out what it sees as American corporate interest in the Middle East, and it's the U.S. guard dog against Arab radicalism and to some extent Arab nationalism, and it's a matter of being able to play off these different powers against one another. Although the United States also gives an equal sum, I believe, to Egypt, and if you sort of and to Jordan, if you add it up, how much money goes to the Arab countries and how much money goes to Israel? I think the Arab countries come out on top. Why in the hell we're giving a penny to any of them is way beyond me. I don't want to give them a cent. I don't want any of my money going to anybody in the Middle East except for the most basic humane undertakings. Not for so that Israel can buy F-16s so then it can bomb civilian populations in Beirut, and not to these grotesque dictatorships like in Egypt and some of these other places. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And all right, we go to a lot of Chris's, and we'll go to a Christine. And is it Richardson, Michigan?
No, it's Adrian, Michigan.
Okay. Well, Jay, you were close. Go ahead, Adrian.
Hi. I was just listening about a half an hour ago, and you said something about American money is going to all these different foreign countries for oil lines and what have you.
Uh-huh.
You know, what's going on with Michigan tax money? I haven't been able to get any, like, medical help from the state. I've been turned down several times for, like, the Medicaid programs and stuff like that. And I work a piddly little job where they don't offer any health insurance. And I just had to go to the hospital because I was having abdominal pains. And my bill was, oh, goodness, it was almost $4,000. And making $6 an hour, how am I supposed to pay this with, you know, all the rest of my bills on top of it, you know? And I just, what can we do as, I guess, third-class Michigan citizens, can we do to help Granholm see that there's more problems than just, you know, the gas?
Well, there's no money. I mean, she knows, as a Democrat, she knows that there should be a national health program that includes everybody in it, that there should be public insurance, so that health insurance ought to be a matter of citizens' rights and not just those of us that are fortunate enough to have a job offer that offers it, or that we can, people that can afford it. There are some states, I think it's Massachusetts, that has, I think, are in the process of putting together a state medical program, but Michigan doesn't have any money. Yeah,
where's our tax money going, though? I mean, we're paying this gas tax. We're paying, what is it, small business tax.
Yeah.
We're paying buku bucks in our medical tax and all this stuff. You know, my fiance, you know, we just finally got off of, he and his family just finally got out of the welfare system. He finally got a job. Thank the good Lord.
Yeah.
And, you know, but he could barely get any help from even Michigan Works.
No, I know.
You know, and it's just.
And this is somebody like Chris. I don't know if you heard him earlier.
Yes, not, I did.
Yeah,
I
saying
did.
That, hey, things are going great. Well, I'm looking at a, let's see, I think you can just go to nationalpriorities.org, nationalpriorities.org, or you can go to my website. Go from there. It's Peter Werbe. My last name is Werbe. PeterWerbe.com.
Oh, yes, I've checked out your website many times. I love it.
Oh, thank you. But Christine, if you go to the side, there says the cost of the war. And right now I'm looking at it. It says the war in Iraq cost $296 billion. That's what we've paid out. That's how much money could have gone for people in Michigan, people in Indiana, people in Nevada to have the proper health care. Now, let's just see the cost in your community. And I think what you can do, that's right, you can put in, let me see if I can do this. Well, you can put in Michigan, and for the entire state, so how do you must have to, hold on here. All right, so if I, hit something and it didn't, all right. So our cost, what we've spent, is $8 billion. This is what we've paid in for, is $8,333,000,000 into Bush's Iraq war. And you can, let's see here, you compare, health, public, and then you can do all this stuff like kids' health, for instance. And what it says here when it comes up is, well, it says we could have insured 177 million children for 1 year. We don't have that many. But that's what math is all about. But in other words, and this thing is ticking. You should see how fast this thing ticks. Pardon me. So, as I said, we're being robbed. We're being screwed. We're being taken for suckers. And you get people that say, oh, things are getting better. Well, I don't know what planet they're on.
Understandable.
All right. Thank you, Christine. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. And actually, we have some open lines for the first time. If you want to grab them, I'd like to hear from you. Here's Darius in Detroit. Darius, hi. You're on the air. Darius, I need you to turn your radio completely off. All right. You just keep listening to that. I'll put you on hold and come back to you. Oh, I got rid of him. Sorry. Call back, and we'll get you on the air. Here's Russell in Redford. Russell, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Got a couple questions, and hopefully I can ask both of them. First one's about the economy. It's clear you're not a Bush fan, and quite frankly, I'm not either.
Well, there's not many left. What's his popularity at now, like 33% or something like that? Yeah.
That's for sure. My question is for you is, do you believe that if our economy is a direct result of Bush's actions, or is it the natural ebb and flow, quote natural, ebb and flow of our capitalist economy?
Well, capitalism does have ebb and flow periods. There's no doubt about that. But we have a situation where Bush came in with a surplus, and then he began this war that was absolutely unnecessary and based on lies, illegal, all of that stuff, which is now, as I just said, has cost $300 billion. And he started cutting the taxes for the very wealthy. Well, if you cut taxes and you create a war, well, duh, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, one thing that I've always confused about this whole war situation, we're not really at war, are we? I mean, it's a war on terrorism, much like the war on drugs.
Yeah, war on drugs. I can't even drive on drugs.
I mean, it's the same kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
My second question.
Well, wait. Let me just say that is hyperbole. It's an exaggeration. What it means is just like we had a war on poverty, and we have a war on drugs, is that we're going to give this tremendous effort towards that. Well, given the success of the war on poverty, since there's increasing numbers of poor people all the time, and given the absolute total failure of the war on drugs, which essentially is just a way that we created this prison industrial complex where we take our tax dollars to arrest our citizens and put them in prisons that are built and all that, it doesn't bode well for the idea of success to call it a war on terror. It's a stupid phrase. No, we're not at war. Go ahead.
My second question is basically about the war. You say it's all for oil. Now, to what end?
Well,
I mean,
I'll tell you what.
Lower oil prices? Because that should have helped.
No, wait a minute. Now, who, the neocons, the neoconservatives, some of the people that were the architects of the war, they kept pushing it, and they wanted a situation where the United States could control oil to the extent that we had an uninterrupted supply, that we had direct control of it. That's why there's military bases being built in Iraq. That's why the largest embassy in the entire world is being built as we speak in Baghdad, even though things are going to hell there. But who of Bush's buddies would not want lower oil prices that Bush is really connected to, and Cheney? The oil companies.
Yeah.
And you know what? The oil companies kicked the neocons' ass because everyone connected with oil. Iran's making a fortune. Mexico, Canada, Venezuela, everybody who produces oil is just loving this. And the only people that, of course, are getting hit are you and me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you calling. Hey, you know, let me see here. Why don't I have stuff in more order? You know, I was always... Oh, I forgot to tell you about this, too. Citgo is owned by the Venezuelan government. So the only way that I can even deal with the fact that I fill up my full-size sedan with gas and look at a bill of $45 is that I know that all of this money, rather than going to like ExxonMobil, who's got to finance this $400 million retirement package for its CEO, it's going to the people of Venezuela. And it really is. Someone said to me, do you know that? Do you know that for sure? You know, these guys, these loudmouth politicians like Hugo Chavez, you know, he could just be lining his pockets or something like that. Well, from every report that I've read, that's in fact not the case. I mean, the rich and some of the middle class that despise Chavez in Venezuela. And remember, I visited there. I saw the barrios, the poor sections. They were pretty terrible, but in them. And I saw these. They had food co-ops. They had medical clinics. And this is one of the things the rich hate them for, is that everyone, they have a lottery to see who gets into the medical schools. It used to be just the rich kids. And, it's going there. So, and I just, you know, if I wish it was lower. Somewhere on my website, I think it's like 20 cents a gallon in Caracas. People really drive. But Citgo is going to cut back. Boy, I can't find it. Going to cut back on it. It's a long, complicated economic thing. But it's costing them money. They're not making a profit on a lot of this gasoline that's being refined. In fact, they have to pay for refined gasoline. So they're going to be not supplying a good number of their Citgo stations across the country. Michigan still will. So the only solace to having gas now, I see it regularly, $3.05 a gallon, the way you can eat that is know that it's not going to line some rich guy's pocket. All the rest of it is. That it's not going to fuel Islamic fundamentalism. That it's, of course, you know, we get a lot of them from Canada and Mexico as well. All right, let's go to Darius. Darius, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, you're calling from Detroit. Welcome.
Yes, Peter. Yes, the Bush first conscientious objector again. Calling about, you mentioned something about the war. We you don't talk about it now. I mean, you don't. What I want to say is, I'm a son of the family of immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And
from what country? What country?
Is Poland. I'm from Gdansk.
Okay.
And one time I heard you about talking about also your ancestry was from Gdansk. I don't know if it was way back. I'm not sure about
way that. Back when it was
way back. Yes, you mentioned something about being from Gdansk.
What was it before it was Gdansk? It was a free city state of Danzig.
It was a German city.
Right,
yes.
Right. Right.
I came here when I was 13. I'm almost 40 right now. Yeah. Anyways, I served, and I followed your advice about being conscientious objective under Bush 1. It never worked out. Unfortunately, there was nobody to turn to when I tried. Anyways, I just wanted to talk about it. Well, like always, when I called you first time, I observed, I wanted this call to be called a demeanor of a species. My mom has worked for a Jewish company, and she worked for a Lebanese company, and the bosses in each one of the companies, when she worked under, perhaps I don't want to steer this program. I know how. I don't want to be racist or anything like
that.
Yeah,
but
yes, I don't want to steer this thing.
Yeah, but go ahead, Darius.
Issue. But anyways, On her Jewish company, she wasn't making any money.
Uh-huh.
She was denied the vacation. She was always.
Well, let me stop you right here because I got to go to a break anyways. There's no such thing as a Jewish company, and there's no such thing as a Lebanese company, except in Lebanon, or a Jewish company in Israel. Even the only thing I would say if there were a Jewish restaurant, which is a delicatessen, or there's some like great Orthodox Jewish delicatessens on Greenfield and Oak Park that has wonderful food that I get frequently. But when you start, I mean, you said you didn't want to be racist, but we have to be very, very careful about our language. And I'm not putting you in this boat, but I'm saying that language says a lot. The Nazis talked about Jewish businesses because they were owned by Jews. Well, the vast majority of Jews have always been very liberal, always been very involved in unions and social movements for peace and social justice. And when you have somebody who is a boss or a capitalist that is functioning in a way that doesn't support their workers, they're a bad boss. It has nothing to do with their ethnicity. All right, Darius, thank you very much.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Night calls number 313-298-WRIF. We go up till 1 a.m., and then we'll have a couple of featured interviews, including one from an expert on the Middle East. He'll be talking about what's going on, and then a wacky but serious interview with a transgendered person who was talking about suicide prevention. And it's not like one of these typical public affairs shows, so stay tuned for that. Abby from Southfield writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I was at last Monday's anti-war demonstration. Now, that was the demonstration. You know, I've got a cold. I feel like I'm going to sneeze. Wow, hold on here. Wow, I've never done this before. I may have to just click the mic off, or can I do mind over matter? There you go. All right. Anyway. Maybe I can read you this article first, then I'll read Abby's email. If police hope to quiet Monday afternoons at 9 Mile and Woodward in Ferndale by arresting war protester Victor Cotilla last week and charging him with disorderly conduct, they failed. Several hundred people clustered there last Monday and filled every side of the intersection holding signs and banners protesting George W. Bush and the Iraq War. Before the arrest, usually 20 to 30 protesters showed up. Phyllis Livermore of Birmingham said it was outrageous he was arrested. We're in support of fighting that. Many said it was their first time at the anti-war event, which started 4 years ago and happens at 4:45 to 5:45 every Monday, which means today as well, this Monday, 4:45 to 5:45 every Monday. Last Monday, Cotilla, 55, was arrested in front of his wife and their 13-year-old daughter and threatened with a taser if he wouldn't give up his sign. Police Chief Michael Kitchen said he was arrested for holding a sign that inspired drivers to honk their horns. Man, call out the cops, right? Ferndale Code says it's illegal to incite people to do that. Police said they'd warn protesters, but this is, no homes and all that. And so Cotilla put up a sign that said, Ferndale police say don't honk, if you want Bush out after the warning. But people still responded by honking until his wife had to pay a $500 cash bond to get him out after his arrest. And some dork of a cop, and I know some of you, well, let me put it this way. I know a lot of Ferndale cops. You're not all dorks. But it was a dorky thing to say. This ain't the 60s. Damn. It should be. It absolutely should be. But his arrest failed to deter a group of teens from Grosse Pointe who held up signs during urging drivers to honk against the war. Michael Fenton, 18, of Grosse Pointe. Well, I hope we didn't drop a dime on him here. I'm not afraid. No one told me specifically I couldn't hold it. Cotillo walked through the crowd, accepting pats on the back and holding and meeting old friends. He said he was afraid for people thumbing their noses at the law. Well, he shouldn't have to be afraid, hey? And he says, I think Ferndale supports us. They know what we're doing out here. His words were borne out by the number of thumbs-up signs, peace signs, and honks drivers bestowed on protesters. This is from the Daily Tribune of last Tuesday. And I got a nice note from Victor Cotilla, the guy that got arrested. He said, I'm an old fogey and a morning person, so you're kind of a stranger to me, and I apologize for that, but I understand you were instrumental in promoting the Ferndale Peace Vigil on Monday. I'm very grateful for your efforts. And he had some other stuff. Well, Abby writes, I was at last Monday's anti-war demonstration. I didn't expect the positive reactions from drivers passing by. I was very impressed. It was just a cacophony, if you will, of horns blaring, including some from big trucks that rattled the windows. I think, don't you get a few birds being flipped at you? No. I met some great people, young and old, who I believe will continue to attend the demonstration until U.S. troops are out of Iraq. However, I wished I could have been in two places at one time last Monday. I wanted to be in Troy at the Marriott to confront the devil himself, President Dick Cheney. That Nancy Springer, the candidate for the 9th Congressional District, was out there. She got some good time on the air. Pardon me. I recruited some family and friends to attend tomorrow's demonstration just a reminder to let everyone know about 9 Mile and Woodward, 4:45 to 5:45. The movement does seem to be growing. It's going to be blistering hot, Abby, and I got to tell you, I wasn't going to go. But just because of your email, I will be there. I hate that weather. But I'm going to be there. So if others, and some of you came up to me and said, hey, I heard you on the air. I appreciate it. Some people, I think it was Kevin and his family came from Plymouth. That's a long way away. Grosse Pointe is a long way away. All right, let's go back to our phones and talk to Eddie. Eddie's in Southgate. Hey, Eddie, hi, you're on the air. It's Peter Werby on WRIF.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a long-time listener. I'm a first-time caller tonight.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been listening to you a long time, and I agree with a lot of what you say, but I'm not saying that you're ignorant of the fact or, you know, anything like that. But
go ahead. I can handle it.
I think you're just reluctant to cross certain boundaries when it comes to, like, you know, certain
Tell me. Come on, you're piquing my curiosity.
I'm reluctant myself to speak on the air about it, but, I mean, I just think that you don't press on some, like tonight I called for the first time. I think that you steer clear of some issues. Well, tonight we're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Mideast crisis. And I'm not saying you're missing the big picture. I think you're very well aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
But I think you don't really press on the important issues that you should be talking about on
like
the air
what?
Right now.
Like what? Tell me. We can handle it. You're anonymous.
Okay, well, I'm not really anonymous. I mean, I'm on a cellular phone, so I'm not that anonymous. But
we're not tracing your call. Go ahead. Come on, we're wasting precious airtime.
Okay, I'm sorry. But I just think that there is a strong Israeli influence in our government today that controls foreign policy in our government and that of Israel, and they coincide with each other.
Well, listen, I said that the Israel lobby is extraordinarily powerful. If you go to the website of like AIPAC, what is it, American Israel Political Action Committee website, or maybe just AIPAC.com or .org, they brag on their website how effective they are in passing legislation. But it is only, I mean, again, this gets back, unless you think that, and I'm sure you don't think that Jews have some special power of persuasion and they can cloud the mind of naive Gentiles, what they advocate is coincidental with the oil and banking and pharmaceutical and other powers that authentically control every aspect of the American government.
Peter, you have to understand, American foreign policy and along with Israeli foreign policy, this is all strategically put in place very, very, very soundly, whether it's through the media. And you got, by the way, the media, you got to do some research on the media, who actually controls their media, by the way. And the information that's being uploaded to
you mean like that Jewish guy Rupert?
Well, I mean,
come on, is that? I don't even want to go here. I mean, this is nuts. Somebody called. Well, never mind. I don't want to go there. I mean, as long as one looks for ethnicity at the root of any problem, no matter where you are in the world, you are off in la la land. It all is essentially about money and power. And to the extent that anybody influences our government to the detriment of the American people, and every lobby does, except, like I say, like environmental ones and unions and what have you. But all the ones that have interests that don't directly affect us, like unions are not, you know, if you go to a union lobby, they're not trying to get the legislation they want, more money for their members. They are almost always representing the interests of the entire middle class and the entire working class, and also carrying the cudgel for the poor as well. Environmental lobbies, that's pretty obvious. Legal reform, things like the Center for Constitutional Rights. But the big lobbies are the ones that can deliver the money, and that's petroleum, that's banking, that's credit, that's pharmaceutical, and the Israel lobby as well. So to kind of single them out, it gets you off on the wrong track. That's all I have to say. All right, Eddie, thank you very much. Here is Carol. Carol's in Detroit. Hi, Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just going to change the subject a little bit.
Sure.
I have two items here. The first one is the date of the first bombing of the civilians.
Yeah.
June the 1st, 1921, North Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street.
You know what? I should know that.
I've got a tape right here with the exact information on it.
But I should know that. That's right. There was this horrible race riot, which was initiated by whites that were essentially jealous of what African Americans had created in the city of Tulsa. And when these white mobs attempted to enter the black district, which was like a middle class area and had all of this thriving business, the black population threw up barricades to protect themselves from these marauding racist white mobs. Another thing I want to mention as well. They were led by something called the African Black Brotherhood. Is that right? The African Blood Brotherhood. I'm sorry. That were made up by a lot of World War I veterans. And because they could not enter that, the city of Tulsa sent planes into the air, which bombed this American city, completely destroyed the black district, and caused all sorts of death and burned it to the ground. Am I correct from memory?
You're correct.
All right. When's the next time in history that an American city was bombed? Well, December 7th, 1941. When's the next time after that an American city was bombed? Not September 11th. That's when the mayor of Philadelphia ordered a aerial bombing of this house that was under siege by the Philadelphia police. It was a group called MOVE, with a capital M, capital O, capital V, capital E, which you can be Googled. And the Philadelphia police plane dropped incendiary bombs that ignited the entire block, killing, I forgot, something like 11 civilians and destroying it entirely. So, yeah, thank you for reminding me.
Okay, there's the one other item I just wanted to add, that one that was complaining about the Michigan's state of politics and money.
Yeah.
The Engler legacy.
Absolutely. That. Yeah. Hey, one other thing. In fairness to what I read earlier, that the first military bombing of a civilians people wound up dead in Tulsa, people wound up dead in Philadelphia, but the first aerial bombing of civilians was in 1927 by the military, by the U.S. Marines bombing a civilian population in Nicaragua.
So you mean because it was military?
It was the military. But you know what? People still wind up dead, don't they?
Yeah, right.
All right, Carol. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'll give it 313-298-WRIF. It's Scott in Chesterfield. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
Good, thank you.
Good. I just wanted to call in real quick. I think that, I don't know if you've mentioned it or not because I've been kind of out of town, but I listen to you religiously on Sundays. There's a great movie that should be viewed by everybody. It's called Why We Fight.
Right.
I can't remember the guy's name who did it because I wrote it down and I lost it, but I mean, it goes right from the beginning, right from Eisenhower's 61 farewell speech, and it just goes right down the line. The thing that I liked about it is, as much as I like Michael Moore, his stuff seems kind of, I don't want to say hokey, but the people that he has on his movies don't seem to have as much credibility. This guy had people from the CIA, had colonels with 20 years experience, had Eisenhower's granddaughter and son both. And the movie is just so enlightening. You have to see it.
Well, I have seen it, actually.
Oh, okay.
I have to tell you this, that I've found, and even Michael's film, I found, after a while, a little boring. The other thing is, since I'm so immersed in this stuff, I never learned a thing from... Mm. I thought the Fahrenheit 9/11 was a good film, and I was I think it changed a lot of minds, and I congratulate Michael for it. And he's not making it for me. He's making it for the general population. But most of those, because they want to have theatrical distribution, they got to put on about 20 minutes more than is necessary. So you get it. Walmart's bad. I get it. I get it. The press lies. I get it. I get it. You know, Bush is a crook. I get it. I get it. But Why We Fight, and you can go to my, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and off on the right, I forgot what it means. I don't know what the hell it says, my own website. It says, this is all the songs, movies, videos, and the rest of popular culture that are bringing down the Bush crime family.
Okay.
Very unbiased.
It blew me away.
Well, you can link on that. Now, one more thing. It's showing in the Detroit area. Why We Fight is showing in the Detroit area on this Tuesday.
Sure.
But you go ahead.
I think that some of your callers should definitely take a look at it. I think that a lot of the questions and stuff that they're calling in on, especially with things being about the Jewish religion or ethnicity, this breaks it down pure and simple. We've become a war machine. We have think tanks that decide what we should do with our war machine when we can't find a legitimate fight. And we haven't had a legitimate fight in years, it seems like. So they make it up. It was the most powerful film I've seen probably 10 years. It did knock me out. So I just wanted to share that with you. And like I said, I've been listening to you for a long time, and I thank you much for being there.
I appreciate it. Thanks for calling. You can go to Sony, like the movies and all, SonyClassics.com/Why We Fight. SonyClassics.com, Why We Fight. And, here is old Ike Easyhower himself on there. If you go to that part of my site, my site's terrible. You got to go really far down. Now, you're not supposed to do that on websites, but you got to really go down there to find it. All right, let's see. Here's Jim. Jim's in Romeo. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Hey, Jim.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for asking.
I'd like to tell you, Peter, if you're really an advocate for the people, how come you don't tell them about ethanol? I never hear you talk about ethanol. Screw Venezuela and Citgo.
Yeah?
Why don't we use ethanol?
I don't know. What I meant by I don't know, that the corporate forces that are arrayed against it are tremendous. And there's people that have a number of criticisms of ethanol. Ethanol based on corn production is not exactly the best thing for the environment.
Read up on it. You'll find out the truth. Bill O'Reilly, I never liked the guy.
Yeah, me neither.
But I like him now. I listen to his show. It's the only thing on radio, plus you. I like your show, too. But here's the thing. You want to know where the tax dollars are going in Michigan and every state in the country?
Where?
The school system. 80%. Why don't mamas stay home or mamas get up early and homeschool their kids? They're doing it all over the West, out West now. They're homeschooling.
Wait a minute. We used to be able to afford. I'm curious of whether your figure about 80% is correct, but someone can probably let us know about that, or you can send that to me. But why all of a sudden, when you and I were kids, that there was no problem with the school system, and now we can't afford it? And you're telling people that the public school system of 150 years old, we got to start educating our own kids.
I'll tell you why. Because like an inventor, you have a great idea, it might not get invented for 150 years. You carry it to the next level. We're carrying this idea to the next level. Just because we didn't have it back 35 years ago doesn't mean it's not a good idea for today.
Well, I don't know that homeschooling for everybody is a good idea. But I got to move on right at the end of the show. Thank you. Let's see. Here's Craig in Westland. Craig, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, man?
Good, good.
All right, What I wanted to talk about more or less was when we were talking about earlier about Iran and their involvement, what's going on with Israel.
Right.
More or less what I'm concerned about is when you talk about radicalist Islam versus the ones that aren't so radical.
Yeah.
I think that more or less, like I read a lot of the Quran and stuff like that, and a lot of it more or less said, convert to Islam, or die, pretty much. I mean,
whatever.
I mean, when you look at it, a lot of people that aren't radical about their religion, that would be like a lukewarm Christian or a lukewarm Islam. It doesn't matter which side you're on; you don't really care.
Well. I know a lot of, I don't know a lot, but I know a number of Muslims, and I don't think any of them hold that belief. In fact, I went to the Arab American Festival in Dearborn a couple weeks ago, and I don't think too many people there held that view either. Wow. All right, we've got to get some quick calls in. Let's see here. Here's Paul in Plymouth. Paul, go ahead real quick.
Hey, Peter. It's Paul from Plymouth.
Hi.
Hey, I just want to kind of change direction here. I was wondering, I just heard some stuff from Bob Seger on the radio. He's got a new song out and album.
A new album, yeah, kind of country-ish.
I was wondering if you knew anything about it, if he was going to go on tour, or, you know, it'd be nice to see a friend of Michigan here back on the road again.
Yeah, sure. I read sometimes things right before I'm going to go to sleep. I read a whole article about it, and I can't remember a damn thing.
Maybe, would you consider playing, too? I know you said it was kind of country. I heard it, too. Would you play at the end of the show?
No, I don't have it available. I don't even think WRIF has it.
Really?
Really. All right. Thank you, Paul. Let's see. Here's our last caller. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hey, you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to comment about your email that you had about the guy that was arrested protesting war.
Yeah.
And I wanted to come out and first say that, you know, I'm not fully against the war.
You're not? How come?
No, I'm not, but I'm against that because whatever happened in the Constitution, freedom of speech and right to protest, right to organize.
There you go.
Whatever happened to that?
Well,
everybody has their own opinion, and I'm not saying that mine's right, and I'm not saying that theirs is right or we're both wrong, but I just think if it comes down to somebody honking a horn or holding a sign over the war, that's just bad publicity for everything, and it's bad for the country.
Well, I agree with you completely, and I have to say that the Ferndale cops backed way off, and sometimes I think their police chief, Kitchen, made a real bad mistake. Now, Tom Barwin, who is the city manager and who unfortunately is leaving the city of Ferndale, is a wonderful man and very progressive. Hopefully he leaned on the guy and said, look, you are going to cause, as it was, they had like anywhere from 8 to 15 people there on a usual Monday. Now they've got 300 people there like last Monday, and probably I'll bet you they have 75 to 100, maybe more. Maybe people listen to me and show up on 9 Mile and Woodward tomorrow at 4:45 to 5:45. Maybe we'll get that many on again. Well, I appreciate what you say. I absolutely agree with you, and thanks for being our last caller tonight. I did want to say, though, God, let me see. Zen sent us an email at calltalkyes@yahoo and said, Power of Nightmares. That's a very, very extraordinary set of videos. And I watched the entire thing, which I don't think I've ever done that. Again, you go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe, WRIF.com. On the right, it says songs and videos and what have you. Click on that, and I think it's right over on the right. Check that out. Thanks, Zen, for sending it. Thanks to all of you for listening and for calling. And, hey, we'll be back next week, but stay tuned for the interviews that I do. And I think we only have, if I'm looking at this right, one or two commercials. So we'll be right back at you.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is deleted by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. As I think many people know, the Middle East is exploding. I'm looking at a screen right now. Israel blasts Lebanon airport, air bases. I should say we're recording this on Thursday, July 13th, give you a perspective, because who knows what's happened in the interceding days up to when this is played. And Israel has intensified its attacks on Lebanon. As usual, when I want to find out what's happening in the Middle East, I go to Chris Tensing. Chris Tensing has been on the Peter Werby Show any number of times. He's the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and he's the editor of the Middle East Report. Chris Tensing, we're reaching you in Washington. Welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's one always hesitates a little when you know that there's going to be a 3 or 4 day interval between when you say something and when an interview is played. But I almost feel like saying, "What in the hell's going on?" I mean, it's suddenly everything's exploding. I've heard some talk that Israel had been planning for weeks. This was in an Israeli paper, an incursion into West Bank and Gaza to get rid of Hamas, where this all started. Does that kind of information reach you?
It's possible that there were such plans, but I think that the immediate reason for the incursion into Gaza was certainly the operation by three Palestinian militant groups to capture the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. And there has also, of course, been the ongoing rocket fire coming from the Gaza Strip into southern Israel, and that was the reason, that has become the other reason behind Israel's incursions into the Gaza Strip and the airstrikes and shelling of civilian infrastructure in Gaza, which has left the Gaza Strip in a real mounting humanitarian crisis, coming on top, as it does, of the already very severe economic effects on the Gaza Strip of the cutoff of financial aid to the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority by Israel, the United States, and the international community.
What, given the relationship of forces, the overwhelming power of the Israeli Defense Forces and all of its modern technological means of warfare, why in the world would either the Hamas guerrilla groups or even more so Hezbollah, the guerrillas that invaded Israel and carried out military actions, could you in any way figure what could be their logic? It would seem that this is exactly what would the result.
Yeah, well, let me disaggregate that question and then try to put it back together at the end. I think the two groups have different sets of motivations. In the case of Hamas, I think it's fairly clear that their leadership, by which I mean the joint Shura Council that unites the Hamas leaders who are in exile, like Khaled Mashal in Damascus, and also the leadership of the military wing and the political wing in Gaza Strip, they decided some time ago that if Israel and the United States and the West in general were not going to let them govern the Palestinian territories and were going to starve them of the financial resources that they need to keep a civil service salaried and running, that they would resume armed acts against Israel, and if necessary, relinquish the reins of government and go back underground and go back to the situation that we had before they joined formal and ran for office in Palestinian elections. So I think that was their calculus behind this operation to capture the soldier, and which results in the death of two other soldiers. They're sending that message that if the world won't let them govern, then the world is going to watch them fight, essentially.
Sort of reminds me, though, of that scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where that one knight keeps getting one arm cut off, then the other, and finally he's got all of his limbs, and he's still yelling, come on, come on, come on. I mean, as I said earlier, the military relationship of forces is surely not to the advantage of guerrilla groups, and this just allows a further pulverizing of the civilian population, as you indicated.
Certainly, and certainly there's no symmetry in this conflict whatsoever. Israel is vastly more powerful than either Hamas or Hezbollah, and more powerful than the two militias put together. And even if there were to be some kind of wider conflagration that would involve states, Israel militarily is quite capable of emerging victorious in such a conflict. There's also the political level, Hamas, from their point of view, I think probably felt that if they did not stage some kind of operation like this, which would show that they are capable of taking the initiative, that they would suffer the same fate in the eyes of the Palestinian public as had their nominally secular counterparts in the Fatah Party, who came to be viewed over the years as simply a proxy police force for an ongoing Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. And Hamas, having spent the entirety of the 1990s lambasting the Palestinian Authority for that, what they described as a concessionary stance vis-a-vis the ongoing occupation, would not want to be seen as weak by Palestinians. And that's also the reason why, despite the pummeling that the Gaza Strip has taken in the last two-plus weeks, there has been no movement from Hamas on releasing this soldier. Hezbollah's calculations are quite different. They certainly, I think, timed this operation in order to capitalize on the outrage in the broader Arab world about what's going on in the Gaza Strip. But I think their motivations probably have at least as much to do with domestic Lebanese politics. Hezbollah has only recently, last year for the first time, joined a cabinet of a Lebanese government. They had been in parliament for some time, but now they have two ministers in the government. And they are under a great deal of pressure from their partners in that coalition, many of whom were key in the movement that forced Hezbollah's former partners, the Syrian army, out of Lebanon last year. And now Hezbollah is under a great deal of pressure to relinquish its arms and disarm its militia, as has been stipulated by a UN Security Council resolution. So I think this is a bit of muscle flexing on the part of Hezbollah, which is showing the rest of the Lebanese government that they have become so big and they are so popular among their constituents in Lebanon that it's not wise to take them on to try and force them to do something they don't want to do. And so I think that's a key piece of their logic in taking, you know, in undertaking the operation that they undertook.
Now, if I'm understanding you correctly, that Israel is correct in its charge that the Hamas governing government in Palestine is, in fact, directly connected with the armed units that captured the Israeli soldier. But is Israel correct in holding Lebanon responsible for Hezbollah's border incursions?
Well, I think probably the prime minister, Ismail Haniyeh, who is a member of Hamas, it's likely that he did not know that that operation was going to take place on the principle of plausible deniability. But I don't think that there is some kind of split between militants and more pragmatic elements in Hamas. I think this was a decision made by the entire leadership of that group. So in that case, yes, Israel is correct to point the finger at Hamas as a whole. In Lebanon, the situation is quite different. Hezbollah did this from all appearances, and I haven't heard anyone, I mean, Hezbollah doesn't present to the contrary either. Hezbollah did this on their own initiative. The rest of the Lebanese government was not informed. They were blindsided by this. They certainly would not have countenance such a move if it had been proposed in a cabinet meeting, and now they're in a very difficult position, particularly after Israel's disproportionate military response, where, similar to in Gaza, they have bombed civilian infrastructure like the airport, like bridges connecting various parts of Lebanon. The entirety of the south of Lebanon is cut off from the rest of the country, and so now the Lebanese government is put in a position where they can't really express displeasure with what Hezbollah has done for fear of appearing that to the Lebanese population as if they are tacitly endorsing the attack that the entire country is under now.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chris Tensing on the Peter Werbe Show. He's the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and he's the editor of Middle East Report. I would highly recommend you taking a look at the Middle East Report, something you can subscribe to. You can go to MERIP.org, M-E-R-I-P, M-E-R-I-P.org. I'll have a link on my site as well, peterwerbe.com. Chris, you used the phrase disproportionate response, and I see that the United States has just cast its first U.N. Security Council veto in nearly 2 years and blocked an Arab-backed resolution that would have demanded Israel halt its military offensive in the Gaza Strip, calling it a disproportionate use of force. If we are wondering, you and I, why this military move would have been undertaken, why is it disproportionate for a nation state under attack to respond in the manner that Israel has?
What Israel has done in the Gaza Strip and also in Lebanon, to so far a lesser degree, is engage in collective punishment. The civilian population of the Gaza Strip, Palestinians who had nothing to do with this operation undertaken by Hamas, are being punished for the acts of Hamas, and the bombing of the power plant in particular in Gaza was, I think, a particularly acute example of this collective punishment. It's very unclear what cutting off electricity to the 1.4 million residents of Gaza has to do with Israel's security.
Well, interestingly, I was just reading Mike Davis's collection of essays called Dead Cities, pardon me, and part of it was about the firebombing of both Japan and Germany. And the British headlines would say, after the Royal Air Force bombed Germany, would say, successful terror bombing. That's what they called the British bombings of Germany. And the idea, of course, was to strike terror into the heart of the enemy. And the majority of people that always died in those bombing raids, of course, were civilians in Europe. So in many ways, what Israel is doing is no different than the United States and Britain did during World War II, both in Europe and certainly against Japan.
Well, I think probably the theory behind the escalated military response is to inflict such a cost on the population as a whole that they will cease supporting or cease rallying behind the groups that Hamas and Hezbollah. But history in the case of this conflict shows that the reverse is often true, that these groups are strengthened when the population pays a big cost. And that, so far, is exactly what is occurring in both in both the Gaza Strip and Lebanon, although Lebanon is this population there is much more divided than the Palestinians are.
Yeah, the Germans actually rallied behind the Nazis where they were towards the end of the war. Support for them was beginning to wane, but when these bombings began, they became furious at the Allies and often beat to death any pilot that was captured. Let's talk a little about whether this could explode into a larger conflict. And again, we're recording on Thursday. This won't be heard for a couple of days, so I don't want to put you in the position of having to say, no, it won't, and then it happened, or say, yes, it will, and then it doesn't. So what can we say now? What are the dangers?
Well, we can lay out, the signs that it will and the signs that it won't. On the dangerous side, it's hard to see in either Gaza or in Lebanon, it's hard to see the tactics that Israel has adopted producing the desired results. In other words, I don't see a resolution of the prisoner crisis happening as a result of this military campaign. I think the likely effect is that both Hamas and Hezbollah are going to dig in their heels. And now, of course, that Hezbollah has linked the Lebanese and the Palestinian prisoner issues, there will be more pressure on Hamas to keep their heels dug in so as not to appear weak vis-a-vis Hezbollah as well. That is a sign that this crisis could go on for a long time, and the longer it goes on, the greater the danger is that it will continue to escalate. There is also the response of the Bush administration to the Hezbollah action in particular, which has been to hold Syria and Iran responsible.
Is this reasonable?
I don't think so. No, I think that there is a tendency in Washington and in Tel Aviv to paint Hezbollah as nothing but a puppet of Tehran, and that I think is a dramatic misreading of what Hezbollah is about. They see themselves primarily as a force within the Arab world. Iran is not an Arab country. They are not an adjunct of a sort of pan-Shiite move to marginalize the Sunni population of the Middle East, as some people think, and as perhaps some hardliners in Iran wish that Hezbollah was, but they are not that. They are primarily an actor in Arab politics and also in Lebanese politics. And I think that they are very much their own masters. They decide when they want to carry out these operations. They may have received a green light from Tehran. This operation may serve some Iranian interests. Iran, of course, is facing its own confrontation with the West over its nuclear program, which the United States suspects is geared toward building a nuclear weapon, and the U.S. has been trying for some time to get Iran before the Security Council and try to get the Security Council to pass economic sanctions against Iran, and Iran may be sort of upping the ante here to sort of get their file before the Security Council sooner, and trusting that Russia and China will resist any pressure from the U.S. to pass sanctions and that the U.S. will face humiliation at the Security Council. And that may happen in the next little while, since yesterday their file was referred back to the Security Council.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is some talk, and I don't know where this even came from, that these Israeli prisoners would be transferred to Iran. That's hard for me to believe that Iran would allow that.
That's a theory coming out of Israeli intelligence. I don't have any way of verifying that. What Hassan Nasrallah, the political leader of Hezbollah, has said is that they have been moved to what he called a very far away and very safe place. I don't know what that means, but I have no way of knowing where those prisoners are at this time.
Chris Tensing, I'm just looking at a headline here online as well. It says, Hezbollah, Israel battle over kidnapped soldiers. Is there a difference between soldiers that are kidnapped and soldiers that are captured? In fact, interchangeably, then they say, we'll exchange, where here it says, two Israeli soldiers captured. Are those words, those verbs important?
Well, in both cases, really, if you look at if your frame of reference is that Israel is engaged in a war with both the Palestinians and with Lebanon. In fact, Israel is still in a technical state of war with Lebanon that has never been resolved since 1967. Then, you know, you could say that soldiers taken by one side or another have been captured. I think in the case of, I think if one were trying to be exact, I think in the case of Hezbollah, the word abducted or kidnapped is probably more appropriate, since there is a UN-approved international border between Lebanon and Israel now. There is still a dispute about the Shiba Farms area, in which Lebanon and Syria have a quite convincing case that the border is drawn incorrectly. There is an, you know, there has been an end of hostilities there, and furthermore, the soldiers were taken in Israel proper, in an area that is not contested by anyone. So I think that's a clearer-cut case of what you could call abduction or kidnapping, if you prefer. In the Palestinian case, I think the word capture is probably more appropriate, since the Palestinians as a whole, even though the Gaza Strip, there are no soldiers and Israeli settlers there anymore, still Israel controls completely that territory and has done ever since the withdrawal last year. They control the border crossings, as shown by the cutoff of finances to the Palestinian Authority. They control the ability of that quasi-government to pay its own staff. So this is not a sovereign entity there. It's still, in that sense, Gaza is still an occupied territory, and the Palestinians are engaged in resistance, which is a right that is protected under international law. And so I think it's more appropriate in that case to use the word capture.
You mentioned earlier the phrase pan-Shiite, meaning the Shiite Muslims in in Iran, but also they have an expression throughout the Middle East, including in Iraq. Does Iraq figure into this at all, and how are the Iraqi Shiites reacting to all of this?
I think Iraq figures into it maybe more at the level of people's imagination. I think there has been since the Shia began to rise in Iraq, and it became clear that in post-Saddam Iraq, the Shia would emerge as a dominant force in any future Iraqi government. There has been talk in the primarily the Sunni majority countries in the Arab world of a quote Shiite crescent that would stretch from Iran through Iraq and then into Lebanon, and that the implication being that such a axis between Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon would threaten the dominance of the Sunni elites in Arab politics historically. That is a specter, I would say. That is something that is not yet a reality, but it is certainly something that is in the back of people's minds. And also, I would say that from the perspective of Iran, there are hardline elements that are back in charge of the government there, and they're including, you know, some members of the revolutionary generation who were coming of political age at a time when the rhetoric of the Islamic Revolution in Iran was very much about spreading the revolution beyond the borders of Iran. And it's possible that some of them still have those aspirations to play a much broader regional role than Iran has played for some time. And they would see Shiite populations in Arab countries as being particularly susceptible to their influence.
Well, 20 years ago or so, people would easily say that the whole situation could be resolved, particularly regarding Palestine-Israel, is simply allowing for a two-state solution, and then everyone would go home happy. Things look look so unresolved and so unstable now, it's hard for me even to visualize a solution, or do ones occur to you more easily?
Well, there are still these are at root political conflicts, and there are still political solutions. In fact, the only solutions to these conflicts are political. In the case of the Palestinians, a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is still feasible. It's possible if there is sufficient political will, primarily in Israel and in the United States, to make sure that that happens. The Palestinians would accept that, provided that it was fair in any way, and provided that it made some provision for the resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem. So the outlines of a solution there have been easily visualized for some time, and the problem is that that the powers that be in Israel and with the support of the powers that be in Washington have not wanted to acquiesce in that solution. And in fact, Israel is now making that solution harder and harder to realize by building a wall in areas of the West Bank and East Jerusalem that should be part of a future Palestinian state, and by intimating that that wall will be a unilaterally declared eastern border of the state of Israel, whether the Palestinians like it or not. That's not a recipe for solving the conflict. In Lebanon, the conflict there is complicated, but it is still tied to what happens on the Israeli-Syrian track. The Golan Heights is another territory that Israel occupied in the 1967 war that is part of Syria, according to the UN, and that it's an occupied territory that is rarely mentioned anymore when one talks about the Arab-Israeli conflict, but Syria does still want to regain it, and Hezbollah, certainly while Syria had its troops in Lebanon, Hezbollah was sort of their Lebanese card in sort of periodically reminding Israel and the international community that this other unresolved territorial issue is still there.
Al, there's a lot there to resolve for, to be sure. Chris Denzing, thanks for being with me. Chris is the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and he edits the Middle East Report, highly recommended by me. Go to MERIP, MERIP.org, MERIP.org. You can get all the information on both the organization and the publication. There'll be a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Chris Denzing, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any Riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or Riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff digital music store at WRIF.com.
Everything.
Get into it.
That
rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Just where you lay down, driving waters till the depths give up their dead. What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said jump on? To myself, don't fall away and leave life bleeding in my hands again. Leave life bleeding in my hands, life
Night Call is back
on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I have a book here that I think will be pretty informative to a lot of us, in the sense that not only does it address a problem, but maybe even a problem you don't know that exists. It's called Hello, Cruel World, 101 Alternatives to Suicide for Teens, Freaks, and Other Outlaws. And my guest is the author, Kate Bornstein. And Kate has been on the show before. I believe we spoke to her about her book, Gender Outlaw, on Man, Woman, and the Rest of Us. And Kate Bornstein was a man, is now a woman. Although, am I correct, Kate? Because here on the back it says you identify with neither a man nor a woman.
That's right. Thank you for having me back on the show, even though I'm neither.
Okay. Well, what that probably confounds all of us.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I love to be confounded because that means
you
grow.
Confound it. How have you ever heard anyone say that? Confound it.
Well, that's better than some of the language I've seen in some of your interviews, Kate. So that's that's great. Okay, we're having too much fun. Tell us, though, that gender seems pretty specific and pretty definitive. I am a man. You can tell by my voice. You can tell by my beard. You can tell by the way I wear my hair. I wear pants. I look like and talk like and act like a man. So there you go. That's pretty ironclad definition, isn't it, or is it?
I suppose so. I mean, in that case, then, what would I be? Because here I am talking to you, and here I am talking to you. And, you know, it's like, so, you know, gender can be played with, like, so many things. And what I found in my journey with gender is that it's more than either or. And that either or, one or the other, being forced to be one or the other very, very rigidly, with some people don't agree with that, can make you really filled with despair.
Sure. Well, when I look at you, you look like a woman. So if I saw you on the street and I'm calling you her and she, and I would identify you as a woman. But
you would? Like, look, there's a woman?
Yeah.
Sorry. Confounded.
Well, I'm just looking at photos.
Okay, great. I like it. I like walking around in the world, quote unquote, as a woman. But if I were to walk around in the world as neither, I'd get beat up. And I have been beat up.
Really?
And that's part of why I wrote the book, because freaks do tend to get beat up when they're walking around the world.
Right. Well, let's, even before we began this interview, we were having a lot of fun and laughing about a number of things. But your book, Hello, Cruel World, 101 Alternatives to Suicide for Teens, Freaks, and Other Outlaws, certainly is a serious subject, and to take the effort to write 101 alternatives, there's a problem. Can you talk at all about the dimension of the problem?
I can indeed. The suicide rate amongst teens has increased threefold since the 1970s in this country and around the world. And among teens, 30% of teenagers who commit suicide question their sexuality or gender identity. That's a large percentage, and there's far too many teens that are doing this.
Now, well, one can almost intuit the 30% that have questions about their sexuality, or who are gay, or who realize they're gay and are taunted, or feel ashamed or humiliated because of their sexual feelings. But the other 70%, we're supposed to be living in this wonderful country where everyone is happy and anyone can make anything of themselves. Ideas? And I suppose it's pretty hard to get a real fix on it because the people that are successful are gone. But why the increase in rate in suicide, and why do we have a country in which suicide is a problem?
I think what's happening is that the country, God bless America, and I mean that, it's wonderful. I wouldn't want to live in any other country. It's given me a great deal of freedom. However, along with that freedom to walk around comes quite a few restrictions in terms of the kind of person you have to be. If you're, let's say, too fat quote unquote. People are going to laugh at you and humiliate you and make all kinds of fun of you. If you're too skinny and a boy, people are going to make fun of you and laugh at you. If you're not smart enough, your parents may harass you to a point where life just doesn't seem like it's worth living that much anymore. And the way it works in this country is we're not allowed to talk about death and dying. That's a big no-no, because if you talk about it, oh, then someone might do it. If you talk about suicide, someone might want to commit suicide, whereas the opposite is true. The more we talk about it, the more we get it out in the open, the less the chances that someone will hide it as a secret and not mention it to a friend or someone who can help them.
You know, Kate Bornstein, could some of the examples you use seem to have been, I mean, I don't know how far back in history they go, but certainly back to when I was a kid, and I think about into my parents' and grandparents' generation, where people were nicknamed Fatty or Toothpick, and so and cruel kids have kind of have always been with us, the kids being cruel and being a bully towards the people, you know, people that don't fit into the stereotype of the perfect peer. So, I don't know, it seems like it'd have to be something a little more dramatic than that, or do you think not?
I don't think so. What you and I would consider, that's nothing, so you're fat, so kids call you fat. Well, you know, when you're in any kind of adolescence, let's say 13, 14, 15 years old, we're just starting to get our feet in the world. We're just starting to figure out how to get along socially. And what are we supposed to look like? Well, oh my God, everybody's staring at me. And I am the target of all the bullies. And it doesn't have to be very dramatic. It truly doesn't.
Your status, though, is fairly dramatic. You were a man at one time, physically, and now you're physically a woman, if I'm correct. And
well, I'm just a drama queen.
Well, okay, I'll leave it at that. But
yes, mine in particular, I've gone a lot further than most people go, which I think qualifies me to talk about being a freak and what it's like to be a freak in this culture.
Well,
and even though, like you earlier said, I seem to be a woman in the world, boy golly, not to everybody, and it's hard walking through the world when you're not perfect, picture perfect, the way the world wants you to be. And picture perfect can be not worshiping the right God, not worshiping God the right way, not worshiping God at all. That can get you picked on.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Kate Bornstein as a teen, as a freak, and as an outlaw, assuming that at some point that you did feel like a freak, if I'm correct. Your upbringing, this book would have spoken to you when you were in your teen years.
Well, I was very heavy. I was fatty, and I weighed about 240 pounds, standing at 5'10" when I was a teenager. And I was also Jewish, in an area where that had very few Jews. We were surrounded by three golf courses, none of which, when I was growing up in the 50s, allowed Jews to be members. And so, right there, there were two reasons. I was also very, very smart. I was incredibly bookish, and so I would get good grades, and I was picked on for that. So I just hid myself away, and I never attempted suicide. I thought about it a lot. I still do. But I never attempted suicide when I was a teen.
Were you, what about the middle? Did you consider yourself a freak, or did people consider you a freak? And sometimes, you know, that within popular culture, you probably remember from the 1960s, freaks were kind of like hippies and rock and roll devotees and all that. So that when I hear that word, I think more of sort of outsiders rather than like a freak show freak.
That's how I'm using freak in the sense in the title of the book. However,
which?
It has an interesting double meaning, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, which way are you using it?
The outsider.
Okay.
The whole notion
one.
Of being an outsider, yeah.
Well, and that ties in, though, to the last part of your subtitle, 101 Alternatives to Suicide for Teens, Freaks, and Other Outlaws. So you're a gender outlaw then. You didn't accept the rigid definitions of what you were born as.
No, I didn't. I did for 40 years. I'm close to 60 years old right now. And it took me until I was in my early 40s, actually at 40 years old, when I went through with my gender change. That's changing now. A lot of folks are doing that much, much earlier, in their teens. And, boy, are they getting picked on. And, again, I want to stress it's not just gender outlaws. It can be religious outlaws, outlaws of class, kids who get picked on because their parents can't afford to buy them the right kind of clothes. And it doesn't stop when you're a kid. That's the other thing. I had originally written this book for teenagers, and my editor and publisher were insistent that I take a look at opening the book up to include adults who get picked on, adults who find life really, really hard, because bullies don't stop being bullies just because they get out of junior high school.
Usually people would say, and I'm taking a little clause here from your introduction of your book, 101 Alternatives to Suicide, freaks and queers and sinners, outsiders and outlaws. And normally, well, conventional conservative people think that's what's wrong with the world. If we didn't have these freaks and queers and sinners, everything would be okay. I guess liberals, too. If you got rid of liberals, everything would be okay. You say the world is healthier because of all these groups. Explain that.
Well, I'm not the first one to say that. I'll borrow someone else's words. Let the person who's without sin throw the first stone. Wasn't Jesus wonderful because he welcomed all the sinners? He welcomed all the people who were not harmful to people, but just lived a little bit differently than other people did?
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. And change usually doesn't come from conventional people that toe the line, do it? Do they? And think about science. It's always people that go outside of the paradigm that bring about the scientific changes. And I was thinking that just, say, a generation ago, an interview with someone like you would probably be impossible. People wouldn't want to air it. They think it would be inappropriate for broadcast.
Yeah. Yep, it certainly would have been.
My guest is Kate Bornstein, and she's the author of 101 Alternatives to Suicide for Teens, Freaks, and Other Outlaws. It's got a foreword by Sarah Quinn of Tegan and Sarah, and it's published by our friends at Seven Stories Press. Yeah, I was looking at some interviews that were sent along as part of your publicity packet, and it said that you won't go to see, and this is now the film has kind of gone away, but Transamerica with Felicity Huffman. Well, my wife and I saw it. We thought it was wonderful and a really touching portrait of someone that has conflicts of was a pre-op transgendered person, a pre-operational transgendered person. But yet you tell your the San Francisco Bay Guardian interviewer that you wouldn't even go see it. What was offensive about it on its face?
Well, the primary thing. First off, I think the film has a lot of heart. The script has a lot of heart. The director showed me the script early on in the development of the piece and passed it around to some other trans folk. The director had a really good heart in writing that, and I don't doubt that at all. And I mean that. What bothers me is that no trans woman was ever considered to play the role that Felicity Huffman ultimately played. And it's kind of like the old days, not so old, in the 40s and 50s, when white guys played all the Native Americans and all the Asians and even all the African Americans in the movies. It's offensive, and especially all the hoo-ha that the studio makes about, oh, look at how beautiful, beautiful Felicity Huffman. Look how ugly she can make herself, just like a real trans person.
I didn't get that from the film. In fact, I had trouble getting my brain around the fact that she was a woman. She's played, I thought, the role of a man. very well. And I mean, I understand. I'm not coming from that point of intense sensitivity about the issue that you are. It was a good film. The trailers all showed it kind of as a comedy, but it was a pretty intense film. And I thought the best thing about it, it showed a real sympathy, and I think you indicated that, for transgendered
yes.
people.
And
that kind of information to get out to people, that these are not people that you should think about stoning, but rather people that you should welcome as part of a very diverse community, right?
Yep, you should, and just as you should welcome any freak, any outsider, any outlaw who's not being mean. Anyone who's doing no harm should be welcome in the world, and that's the whole point of the book. There are these 101 alternatives in this book, Hello, Cruel World. Some of them are immoral. Some of them are illegal. But they don't hurt anybody. And I think that's the next step we need to take. As a culture, as America, we need to start welcoming people who are simply not hurting anybody else, even though they're a yep. little odd.
A little different. Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe, Kate Bornstein, we should get to some of these, because the book, 101 Alternatives, people are probably saying, okay, so name a couple. Well, I'm most interested in the immoral and the illegal. So,
of course you are.
So let's start with the immoral. And again, you provoke humor in me, which is, of course, an excellent quality in you. And yet, this is extraordinarily serious. We're talking about people that may be that may use this as a handbook that would save their life. So I'm kind of going at it both ways, understanding what the real serious purpose of it is. But immoral, what one of the 101 do you advise as an immoral alternative to suicide?
Get laid.
Okay.
You know, and I think the wording of it is get laid, please. Boy, you know, having great sex can make life worthwhile, and yet sex is called immoral by so many groups, and it can really twist people around. And I'm not even talking about homosexual sex. It can be heterosexual sex. It can be masturbation. Look what happened to Jocelyn Elders, just for saying, hey, go ahead and masturbate.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So I was going to say, because sometimes people's depression is based upon the fact that they feel like they have no one in the world, and not a partner, and not a sexual expression in their life. But you can always have sex with hopefully someone you love, which is yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And actually probably have better results.
Okay.
Know what I'm talking about.
How was it for you? It was good. Yeah. am I going to have my job after this? I probably will.
Oh, I hope so.
Oh, I will, Kate. Don't worry. Hey, what about the illegal? What should you're giving illegal advice here? I'm risking this more. But go ahead. What illegal in here?
Oh, boy. All right.
Or shouldn't we go there?
Well, we can go there, but this might cost you your job. I need to say that each of these alternatives is graded on a scale of safety and how effective, and it can anywhere from 4 hearts to 4 skull and crossbones. And one of the ones with more skull and crossbones is one of the illegal ones, which is to take drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, people have been taking drugs forever.
Yeah.
Ever since someone picked something up out of the ground and put it in their mouth and said, whoa, that makes me feel better. We take drugs when doctors prescribe us to take drugs, and in fact, that's what I tell people to do. If you think you need to take a drug to feel better, go see a doctor. You'll probably be able to get prescribed a good drug to take. But if it comes down to, let's see, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to take drugs. I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to take drugs.
So you
take the drug.
Yes.
Take the drug every time. I try to warn people in the book, it's not too smart, because you may not be able to stop ever. It may end up killing you. It's not a great alternative to killing yourself. But if it buys you some time to find another reason to keep on living, go ahead and do it.
So a pharmaceutical, legal, a prescribed drug.
Oh, no.
No, I know what you're saying. I was just sort of summing up. is probably best. So, I mean, if you're depressed to the point where you think you're going to commit suicide, better Paxil or whatever those other things are than killing yourself. And if but I know it's, you have them rated because oftentimes, sometimes drugs and a drug that the people unable to control their drug usage see alternative as a suicide. I know at least two people that that happened to. So that would be the worst advice in the world to them, but you have that ranked, right? And hopefully they'd be smart enough to say, wait a minute, that's not the one I want. That's my problem.
Yeah, there's only one rule in the book, and that's what makes each of these 101 alternatives, even the immoral and illegal ones, work. And the rule is, don't be mean. And we all know what being mean means, so I'm not even going to try and describe it. I don't even try to describe it in the book. Just don't be mean. And if you're not being mean, then you go ahead and do whatever you need to do in order to stay alive.
All right, let's talk to some of the parents, for instance, that are maybe coming from church or something like that in your book, 101 Alternatives to Suicide. What would be ones that you would feel good about, say, that that maybe this is what they should look at, or their kids who are the ones at risk should look at?
Well, I think treat yourself like an honored guest comes to mind. We spend so much time beating ourselves to alternative number four. We spend so much time beating ourselves up. You wouldn't beat up someone who was invited into your house, whom you invited into your house. Well, try to practice not being mean to yourself. Try to practice treating yourself like an honored guest. One would be make a wish, as simple as that. I mean, do you remember, Peter, when you were a kid and you would blow out the birthday candle and, you know, you would make a wish? Did it make you feel better?
Sure. I never got
Why
it.
Why did you stop? You know, it's kind of like,
because I never got it.
Well, no. Well, it doesn't mean. Well, that's like people who pray for something and they say, oh, God didn't listen to me. Well, God has his own time, not necessarily yours.
Yeah. Well, maybe a few more. I'm looking at the clock. We have a few minutes more. What is number 72? Give up nouns for a day. What does it mean to give up a noun?
Oh my golly, I love that one. There, in the Navajo Nation, in the language of the Navajo Nation, there are no nouns because they believe that nothing is permanent. Nothing stays the same. Nothing from moment to moment is the same thing. So something is not, for example, a chair. It's chairing. And just this whole idea of getting away from something that's fixed, something that's rigid, something that can't change, spending a day focusing on the notion of change can make you feel really, really good.
You said...
So can number 65, go shopping. I mean, you know?
Okay.
And, or get a makeover, or moisturize. They're not all horrible things. Take a walk in the woods. There are some other scary ones, like find a God who believes in you. If you find yourself doing something that God really says don't do it, and you really, really understand that what you're doing is not being mean to anyone, well, apologize to your God. Say, look, I'm going to find another God, one that believes in me and understands that I'm not being mean. There are plenty of gods and goddesses.
I suspect that your book has to be read much before people are at the moment when they're actually considering this. That is to say that if you're at a point of such depression or whatever else impels people to take their own lives, going shopping ain't going to do it. So this is something that is helpful way in advance.
Also, well, however, the book, the title of the book, I know the cover is a bit confusing. The title of the book is Hello, Cruel World. And there's a quick start guide in here. And the very, very first thing I suggest people do is call a suicide hotline. If you're that close, there are some great people working and staffing the suicide hotlines, or simply talk to a friend, or see a doctor or a therapist, or call the police if you're in the position to do that and you feel safe enough to do that, or emergency services if someone is really hurting you and making life terrible for you. I believe that people should know what they the time-honored ways of staying alive,
you know,
when you're confronted with the notion of killing yourself might be.
You know, okay, Bornstein, I'm looking at its title, Hello, Cruel World, so it's not that confusing. It's not, I've been confused. It will be on my website, peterwerby.com, as well. My guest has been Kate Bornstein, and her book, Hello, Cruel World, which I misidentified by only its subtitle a bunch of times. Hello, Cruel World is the actual title, 101 Alternatives to Suicide for Teens, Freaks, and Other Outlaws, available from Seven Stories Press. You can go to sevenstories.com. I do believe is the correct, sevenstories.com. And I want to tell you, too, that someone that I know who is a pre-op transgendered person was just so excited with the fact that I was going to interview you, and said that he's going to have a lot of people listening, and your experience has meant so much to him. So thank you for this book, and I think it's something, it's not just for kind of the outlaws that we've been talking about, but it gives you an idea also about life itself and what people who are a little different go through. Kate Bornstein, thanks for being with me on the Peter Werby Show.
This is WRIM.com. Roseville this Wednesday night. Wild Woodies wants you to get revved up as Detroit Speech Ups presents Models and Muscle Cars, featuring the girls of Crow Magazine. Join the Riff's own Doc of Rock, Doug Podell, for your chance to score one of 101 pairs of concert tickets, bitchin' music, beautiful women, cold drinks, and hot cars. It's Models and Muscle Cars this Wednesday night at Wild Woodies. On Gratiot, south of 14 Mile in Rockin' Roseville with 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
talking with Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson, I love you.
Hello, Jay Hudson.
You're listening to Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
What's up, Motor City?
I need to hear that, man.
One bad ass mother.
There is none higher.
Mr. Jay Hudson.
You're my boy.
Party with Jay Hudson.
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
I'm calling the shots.
Oh,
this is a nightmare.
Yo!
You're rocking out with Jay Hudson.
Well, Lottie frickin' duh!
101 WRIF Detroit. Everything that rocks.
You're special, you do. I can see it in your eyes.